May we start complete. I hope that we all have copies of today's program. In case you don't, please indicate. Toby is at your service to make that one available to you. But if we all do, then maybe let us get into the business of the day. Acting Director General, we wish to welcome you and your delegation. It's always a pleasure to have you around in Parliament. I think by way of starting, as it's our long established tradition, to try and say Aritsibaneng, so that by the time we engage in the discussions, we at least know who is here from the department, who is here from National Treasury, who is here from the AG's office, and who is here from amongst the members of Parliament. So I'll hand over to you and your colleagues to introduce yourselves. I suppose the minister should be on her way coming, then I suppose.
Chairperson, honourable members, good morning. I'm Trevor Balsa, the acting DG for Water Affairs. And thank you for the welcome, Chairperson. Minister is indeed on her way. I'm sure she will walk in while I'm still doing the introductions. If I could just introduce my team.
Acting DG, let's do this. I'm sure they would love to introduce themselves, so you can allow them to do so. Yeah.
I thought it would just help me to get into the swing of things. That's fine. I'll go from my left and just ask the team to introduce themselves. Thanks, Chair.
Okay, sure.
Good morning, honorables. I'm Thabiso Mfunda Kobile, acting CFO.
Good morning, Chair. Good morning, honorable members. My name is Cornelius Reiters. I'm the Deputy Director General for National Water Resources Infrastructure.
Good morning, Chairperson, honorable members. I'm Philip Butta, Chief Director of Finance.
Good morning, Chair. Good morning, honorable members. I'm Shirley Thomas, Chairperson of the Audit Committee.
Good morning, Chair. Good morning, honorable members. I'm Lindy Welisenga. I'm Deputy Director General, International Relations, Water Affairs. Thank you.
Morning, honorable members and chair. My name is Mbangiseni Mfumbata, acting Deputy Director General, Policy and Regulation.
Good morning, chair. Good morning, honorable members. My name is Adam Bokoshi. I'm the acting DDG for Corporate Services.
Thank you very much. Can we start this side?
Morning, honorable members. My name is Tande Kambasa, and I'm the DDG responsible for the provinces in the department.
I am Babala Manyakanyaka, Policy Coordination in the Acting DG's Office.
Good morning, Chair, Honourable Members. I'm Moshito Mapanga, Chief Director, Internal Audit, Water Affairs.
Good morning, Chair. Good morning, Honourable Members. I'm Tulani Nduli, Chief Risk Officer.
Good morning, Honourable Members. I'm Vincent Munene, Parliament Support in the Office of the Acting DG.
Good morning, Chair. Good morning, honorable members. I'm Darrell Harvey, the acting chief director, HR.
Thank you very much. National Treasury.
Good morning, Chair and honorable members. I'm Beatrice Maggi, responsible for Water Affairs Budget from Treasury side.
Good morning, Chair and honorable members. I'm Irene Matato from National Treasury Office of the Accountant General.
Good morning, Chair and honorable members. My name is Ntelekhel Lebelwane. I'm the Director of Operations Support in the Office of the COO, Chief of Operations.
Good morning, Chair and honorable members. My name is Boem Kadipi. I'm in the Minister's office.
My name is Mandla Mathebula. I'm the Minister's spokesperson.
I'm a member of the media, Liesel Pijper from De Burger.
Welcome, De Burger. All right. Thank you very much. Kali, ngazazisa ne team yako. Welcome you.
Thank you, Chair, and good morning, honorable members. My name is Tembegile Makwetu, Deputy Auditor General.
Morning, Chair, morning, members. I'm Alice Miller, Corporate Executive in the Auditor General.
You don't usually sound like that. But anyway.
Good morning, Chair, honorable members. My name is Gornay Mabir. I'm a Business Executive in the Auditor General.
Good morning, Chair, honorable members. My name is Caroline Mampuru. I'm the Business Executive for Investigations.
Good morning, Chair, honorable members. My name is James Aguma. I'm a Senior Manager at the Auditor General.
Morning, Chair and honorable members. I'm Vikas Janssen from Rensburg, Senior Manager at the Auditor General.
Thank you very much. And we have members of parliament introducing themselves, starting from KwaZulu-Natal.
Good morning, Chair. I'm Naren Singh, member of SCOPA.
Good morning, Chairperson. I'm Gertrude Sal, member of SCOPA.
Victor Julius, member of SCOPA, and my colleague Mark Steele will join us soon from the side.
He's our colleague too.
Roy Ainsley, member of SCOPA.
Good morning. I'm Sabelo Chilwane, member of SCOPA.
Yes, good.
Mosambe Matere, Tafes.
Portfolio committee, yes.
Yeah.
Faith Mugambi, member of SCOPA.
Member of SCOPA.
Taven. Lamrawa Tevejane, the local committee, our Sakamela Matota.
Thank you very much. I'm Comrade Temba Goti. I chair this committee. Right. So we'll start, comrades. My understanding is that the minister is a little bit delayed, but she'll be here in no time. So we will continue. DG, I'm sure you'd appreciate that the work of this department is very, very important in the lives of all of us, water. But that is a committee we look at the annual reports, especially matters related to financial management. And if there are areas that the Auditor General had queried, which we ourselves believe that there is need to engage with you around, we'll request for this kind of engagement. But it is nothing more than an exchange of information. I think from our side, we would want to be informed more by yourselves, so that we can better understand what are the issues, what are the challenges, and what are the solutions. Unfortunately, time is a commodity we don't have in much supply, so we would want that the responses be direct, spare the history and the context, so that we could cover as much ground as possible. As you'll be aware, we should have had this engagement sometime late last year, but we had to give some space so that, because we had a new team, some work will be done so that when we engage today, at least we can have some answers to some of the challenges. As you should be aware, it is not only about the annual report, but also the performance audit done by the Auditor General within within the department. The report came out sometime mid last year, in May last year. Well, with that, I will hand over to Comrade Ainsley to take us through.
Comrade Chair, thank you very much. First, I think we must express our disappointment that you have received a qualified audit for this financial year that we are reviewing. Last year, you received an unqualified audit. The previous year, you received a qualified audit on one item. But this year, you are qualified on three items, all under assets. So it is really quite a big step backward. And so I think in our engagement today, the main purpose of our discussions will be what happened, what went wrong during the financial year under review that you have slipped back in a fairly dramatic way. And I will be dealing with items in the annual report from page 91 through to 94, almost the whole report, specifically with immovable assets, movable assets, goods and services, certain leadership matters, and certain governance issues. Those five areas I will be dealing with to see if we can uncover what went wrong this time around. Why qualification this time and the previous year an unqualified audit? But maybe I should start with leadership first, because throughout the Auditor General's report, across all departments and across all public entities, this question of leadership keeps on arising. And I think we ought to hear from your side to what extent a lack of leadership has resulted in this qualification. There are several levels of leadership. Let us look at the level of the officials in the department. There seems to be a great deal of instability, Chairperson, at the top levels of this department. We have heard today that we have an acting DG here, we have an acting CFO here, we have an acting DDG, another acting DDG, and an acting chief director. This is causes serious concern that one has such instability at the top of an important department such as this one. When can we expect some kind of stability in the department, at least with the confirmation of some of these senior appointments? Can we get a response?
Yeah, acting DG.
Thanks, Chair. Do you mind if I take my jacket off?
If it's too hot, you are free to take it off.
It's out of comfort more than anything else. When I'm working in my office, I normally have the jacket off if you don't mind. Chairperson, to Honourable Member Ainsley, thank you very much. Yes, it is a difficult situation when you come to SCOPA and you introduce half of your team in acting capacities. That's really as a result of the outcome of the special report, Chairperson, which you mentioned will also be the subject of discussion today. Whereby certain actions were taken against the DG at the time, and that process is being brought to a conclusion at the moment. There's just a dispute that's been declared around the outcome of that disciplinary process. Thus, the reason for me acting as DG. The other acting positions relate essentially to the CFO, acting CFO, which is also a process which has gone through a disciplinary hearing. The final arguments on that particular disciplinary hearing took place this past Friday, and we are expecting the presiding officer to provide us with his outcome of that process within the next day or two. The DG Corporate Services, and you had Mr. Bokoshi introduce himself as acting DDG. Likewise, as part of that disciplinary process out of the Special Auditor General's report, that disciplinary process has started, albeit that the hearings have been delayed and are now due to take place. And if I could just, if you wouldn't mind, just check the dates when that disciplinary hearing starts, if I could. Okay, 30th and the 31st of March. It has been postponed on two occasions at the request of counsel on both sides. The latest delay being counsel from our side, or the presiding officer, sorry, who's also an acting judge. So the filling of those particular posts cannot take place. Am I too close to the mic? Cannot take place until such time as the disciplinary processes have been concluded. So for the time being, Chairperson, we're going to have to work on the basis of having some acting positions in place. We can't advertise those posts while the disciplinary process is underway. That would preempt the outcome of the disciplinary processes.
All right. That accounts for three acting positions, the DG, the CF, and one of the DDGs. But there's also another acting DDG here, an acting chief director. Why are they in acting positions? You have not indicated that is passed as a result of a disciplinary process. Why are they acting?
Chairperson, the acting DDG PNR, that post, a decision was taken just to hold on the filling of that post. The incumbent of that post resigned and moved to take up a post in KZN. And that post has not been filled because we are going through a restructuring exercise where we anticipate that the policy and the regulatory elements or responsibilities of the department will be split. And consequently, the post will only be filled once that process has been completed. The acting chief director, HR, that's as a result of the acting positions at the top. Having taken Mr. Adam Bokoshi into an acting position as DDG Corporate Services, substantively he's the Chief Director HR. So putting him into an acting position, I've then got to fill that position. So it cascades down somewhat, and that's the reason that Advocate Daryl Harvey is Acting Chief Director, Human Resources.
Okay.
Thanks, Chairperson.
So it has a sort of, it has a knock-on effect, as it were.
It has a tremendous knock-on effect through your chair to Honourable Ainslie down the line, in that I've got to take folk at a lower level and shift them up into an acting position one level up. So you see that knock-on effect cascading down.
In the Auditor General's report, he's quite specific about the actions that the accounting officer did not take. If you look at an annual report on page 93, under compliance with laws and regulations, and also under that little paragraph there, headed leadership, quite specific about the things that the accounting officer did not do. The accounting officer did not exercise sufficient control over procurement processes. This led to irregular expenditure. Under leadership, the accounting officer did not exercise sufficient control over supply chain management. This led to irregular expenditure. Now, I want to know what actions, if any actions at all, have been taken against the accounting officer for these infringements of the PFMA. Are there any disciplinary measures related to these two items that the accounting officer has to account for? And has anybody else been called to account for non-compliance with control over supply chain management and procurement processes? Specifically, not only the accounting officer, although the AG mentions only the accounting officer, What about the former CFO? What about others who did not comply with the PFMA in regard to these two items?
Chairperson, I did consult with you beforehand just in terms of getting some of my team members just to support, and if I could, just with regard to the accounting officer, request Advocate Daryl Holby just to respond in terms of the charges that were covered in terms of that disciplinary process, and then I will deal with the others if I could, if that's in order, Chair. Daryl?
Your Honourable Chair, Honourable Ashley, the accounting officer was indeed charged on 13 counts of procurement irregularities. She was subsequently found guilty on the counts and subsequently dismissed as of the 31st of October. There is a dispute pending. The Minister has further taken a decision to engage the officers of the Special Investigation Unit to establish if there are any civil or criminal activities that may be linked to those irregular expenditure. That investigation is still pending. However, as a result of that, as mentioned by the DG, the Chief Financial Officer has also been charged for similar offences relating to irregular expenditure. He has since been found guilty, and we are awaiting within the next 2 days the outcome of the sanction in respect to that matter. As also indicated to you, the Deputy Director General Corporate Services has also been charged for the similar irregular expenditure, as well as the Chief Information Officer. The department, as of the 23rd of November, has also informed 7 members of the Department Bid Adjudication Committee that an investigation is ensuing against them. The acting DG had taken a decision to suspend the functioning of those members within the DBAC and has since formed an interim committee, which is led by his top management team, as well as regional representatives at a chief director level and members of the supply chain committee. So these investigations are pending. They are not only at a disciplinary level, but the department has decided to pursue criminal investigations against the members implied in the report, as well as a process of civil recovery. Our specific instruction, Honourable Chair, to the SIU is that in the event that we are able to secure any type of conviction in a criminal court, we will also be pursuing a Section 300 request for compensation through the criminal courts, that if anybody was seen to have been enriched as a result of these irregularities, that the asset forfeiture unit will then take effect to seize the assets. Thank you, Honourable Chair.
All right.
Thanks, Chair. Abigail Hobby took it a bit further than I anticipated he would, but just to touch on the Departmental Bid Adjudication Committee, he did indicate that I suspended the Bid Adjudication Committee, which was referred to in the special report of the AG, and established an interim committee made up of the DDGs of the department and supported by supply chain practitioners, and that DBAC sits under the chair of DDG National Water Resources Infrastructure, Dr. Cornelius Reiter, sitting on the on my left. We are also in the process at the moment, and I mentioned it's an interim committee, of going through the process of identifying officials in the department who will be appointed to a new departmental bid adjudication committee. They will be undergoing training before they get appointed to that position, and we will be doing a shorter rotation in terms of their tenure on the bid committee, and we are using a 1 year. Yeah, we'll be using a 1 year rotation, so that we don't get any member who might get entrenched into the committee and around decisions that are made and the way the committee operates. So that's the action we've taken on that, Chairperson.
Okay, no, I think we must commend that action. It's very strong, tough action. It's across the not only officials, the bid committee, it's involving the Hawks, the SIU, Asset Forfeiture Unit. That's the kind of strong action that we want, and I think we want to commend that. But chair leadership was just not directly result in the qualified audits. The main direct result reason is the assets. So please, I want to move on to that now, if I may. And I would turn to page 18.
Yeah, maybe, Comrade, before you proceed, just to remind everyone that please, may we have our cellular phones switched off. Because when it rings, even if it's on silent, it disturbs the recording. Because our conversation is being recorded. So if your phone rings, whatever is being said at that time is not being recorded. So please, just switch it off. You'll switch it on after this meeting. Please.
As okay. I said, yeah. The direct reason for the qualification, not leadership, although leadership plays a part, it's assets, and assets. Three aspects of assets. And if you can give us an indication of what is the problem with keeping an asset register in the department. But first, look at page 18. Page 18 of the annual report, if you will. Page 18K, asset management. On page 18. Have the officials got a copy of the annual report, I suppose so. Page 18, top there, K, asset management. I want to read the last sentence. The department asset register is continually maintained by conducting monthly reconciliations. As a result, the asset register is reconciled and reliable. You live by that statement now in the light of the Auditor General qualifying you on assets.
Chairperson, having been qualified on that particular item, it's very difficult to live by that statement. But I can certainly indicate some of the actions that have been taken with regard to dealing with the issue of immovable assets.
With your permission. Starting on page 91.
Okay. Before we break it down, let's welcome the minister. Comrade Minister, welcome. We were informed that you were delayed, so we nonetheless continued. just before we continue, just to make sure that the minister is able to follow the engagement. Comrade Minister, the officials are responding and will be responding to issues. So from where you are seated, at the end we'll give you some time to talk to any of the issues that you might have noted during the process of the hearing. So as we interact, you may note down, or some issues might be referred to you by comrades here, you can note them down, and at the end we'll give you the opportunity to respond. Yes, Comrade Roy.
Okay, so on page 91, the first of the three aspects of assets for which you receive qualification is in the area of immovable assets. In fact, if you turn to note 32 on page 146, the AG tells us that he was unable to confirm the existence and completeness.
Page
146. AG was unable to verify the existence, completeness of assets to the value of over 33 million rand. If you look at page 146, there is a table of those immovable tangible capital assets. There they are, they're listed there. Before we discuss the figures, can you just tell us what some of these items relate to? There's an item there, as you can see in that table, dwellings. What is the difference there between dwellings and non-residential buildings? If you can just indicate what residential buildings would the department have on its asset register, before we get into the actual figures. And also, while you're on that, looking at that table, if you can explain to us heritage assets, what are those? And also land and subsoil assets. If we can get, I think we need to get some kind of indication of when the AG talks about assets, immovable assets, what is he talking about? So just a very, very brief explanation regarding those four items.
Chairperson, the question was in two parts. The first question which you raised just as Minister was coming in was for me to give a response in terms of the three items, immovable assets, and goods and services.
Can we do them one by one, please?
I will do, yeah. And then Honourable Ainslie asked particular questions around Note 32. So, Chair, if I could just deal with the first three items on a one-by-one basis, and then I will ask one of my colleagues just to help me in terms of the descriptions on the classifications there as well.
Commissioner, sorry, could we just deal with immovable assets first, because then I have other things to say on the other two, movable and goods and services. Can we do it specifically just now with immovable before we move on to the other two?
All right. Let's deal with immovable assets.
In your hands, Chair. So, Chair, just in terms of the immovable assets, if I could just indicate that at the time of the audit, the immovable asset register in question was part of the water trading entity, immovable asset register. And when we did the refinement process of the water trading entity, immovable asset register, we discovered that some of the assets should in fact have been reclassified and included in the main account register. Because we're running two accounts in the department. We've got the trading account and we've got the main account. And some of the assets had in fact been included on the wrong asset register. So the infrastructure valuation report containing this reclassification was submitted to the main account auditors at the time, but due to the time that it was submitted, there wasn't sufficient time to verify the existence and the completeness of those immovable and tangible capital assets, even though as we saw, the auditor responsible for the trading account did verify the existence of those assets. So they appeared incorrectly on the trading entity, and we had to move them onto the main account. That misallocation has subsequently been rectified, and I have supporting documentation, Chair, with me, which indicates the infrastructure valuation report, and also a list of the assets which have been transferred from the water trading account to the main account. And, Chair, I can also provide, and I've got it in the compact disc CD basis, a CD containing a schedule of both the movable and immovable asset registers. It's just too big to carry it around as a paper copy in terms of the extent of the assets which the department has. So, Chair, just in response to that first question, that is the action that has been taken, and I can certainly leave those schedules with you.
The AG complains that he was not able to complete his work because he was not able to produce a final asset register. Why is that? And if he were to visit you today, would you in fact be able to produce, say, here is the final asset register?
Chairperson?
Well, I mentioned asset registers are never final. But it's final, up to a particular date anyway.
Personally, in response to Honourable Ainslie, I thought I had covered that in my response, indicating that the information on the assets that were incorrectly recorded in the trading entity were provided to the Auditor General's team at the point where they couldn't do that verification. That has since been rectified. And my answer to you would be, as I sit here, yes, and that's why I do indicate that I've got a CD available as much as I can confirm, sitting here subject to another audit by the AG, that I believe that the asset register is complete.
Chair, if you could, through you, just indicate the difference between dwellings and non-residential buildings in that in that list, and heritage assets and subsoil assets, give an indication of what these assets are.
Chairperson, as arranged with you earlier, if I could just pass that on to one of my colleagues to respond to, and Tabi Singh. Who's going to do it? Tabi Singh.
Thank you, Chairperson. Briefly, in terms of classification of assets, when we refer to dwellings, we refer to buildings such as workshops and stores and office buildings that are in the substations of the department. And the non-dwellings of the assets that we are referred to is the measuring facilities that are used at the dams, as well as treatment works assets. Those are the types of assets that we are referring to. That is briefly.
Then heritage assets and subsoil?
Heritage assets, those were the biological assets that were since been moved to the Department of Agriculture. But at that time, when we reported, the assets were still in our book.
I don't think that's being helpful. Biological assets. That's still another...
Oh, okay. I'll try to simplify it. It's forest trees. Those are the biological assets.
I'm sure we know a lot of these biological assets. And subsoil assets?
Subsoil, that is the land. It's part of the land that is used by the department.
And what is land assets?
Land assets is where the department is the land, but there's also buildings that are within the land, and therefore we classify that as land.
All right. That's right. You're complicated.
My colleague is whispering to me, where do rivers fall? How do you classify rivers?
There are also solitudes on the assets, but my colleague wants to assist.
No, please. Serious question. Not a serious question. Can we deal with the other two remaining aspects of assets together? Movable assets and goods and services. Because the main finding there is that there is a discrepancy between what you have as a closing balance on page 142. If you turn to 142, page 142, the AG finds that with regard to movable assets, there is a discrepancy between your final closing balance of, what is it, 19,724,000, and what is actually on the asset register. He says, on the asset register itself is 48,257,427. Can you account for this discrepancy between what is your closing balance and what is on the asset register? That's with regard to movable, tangible, capital assets. He has a similar finding with regard to additions to these assets, that your closing balance is different from what is actually on the asset register. And there, too, there is a discrepancy between the two figures. He says there's a lack of documentation, and he was not able to verify the correctness of these items. Can you give an explanation as to why there's a discrepancy, number one, and two, why no documents?
Chairperson, correct. There was a problem. And the main cause was a misclassification between our movable assets and our goods and services. So I'll talk to them together. And in order to correct this misallocation, we have passed the necessary journals. However, there were delays in processing those transactions on time for the audit, which resulted in the overstated goods and services as disclosed. The figure and an understated capital assets figure. This means that the goods and services reflected, acquisitions that should have indeed been captured under the capital account. And with the work we've done to reconcile that, we should now be able to have a better reconciliation with the asset register. To prevent a future occurrence of this nature, we do make sure that journals are passed monthly and that reconciliations are passed monthly. So that's where we are with the movable assets. With regard to the goods and services, it links back to the earlier response on the movable assets, a cause being the misclassification between movable assets and goods and services, which means that the goods and services reflected acquisitions that should have in fact been captured on the capital account. And once again, we're dealing with journals and reconciliations on a monthly basis. And I certainly hope, Chairperson, that the result of those reconciliations will indeed show in terms of the audit for the 10-11 financial year.
Chair, the department never seems to be quite ready for the Auditor General. The documents are always there, but they're not quite ready enough for when he comes to do his audit. I mean, do you have a specific audit unit in the department that deals with preparations for when the Auditor General comes, so that in fact documents are there and ready for when he does the audit, the asset register is there and ready? It's no use after the fact to say, yes, we have the documents, but we were not ready for the Auditor General. I mean, you need to be better organized, I think, to ensure that you are in fact ready with all the documentation, with the asset registers for when he does come. And so who deals with these audits? We've discovered in other departments, we had Defense last week, they have a special dedicated audit unit that deals with many of these issues. Number one, that's the first question. And related to that, do you ever ask for outside assistance to ensure that these problems here that you encounter, that you're able to overcome them in time for the auditor, the audit when the Auditor General's office arrives to do the audit? We again heard from Defence that they called in outside assistance from Treasury. And even I think someone from the AG's office has been seconded, if I'm not mistaken. Am I right? Seconded to this unit in Defence. And what is the result? A dramatic decrease in the number of qualifications from, I don't know, 11 or 12, right down to 1. So I'm wanting to know how you do things. It seems to me that you are not prepared, either in terms of time or in terms of capacity, for when the AG arrives to do the audit. And how can this be avoided?
Chairperson, thanks for that. I think we will be better prepared, and not I think, we will be better prepared or are better prepared dealing with the current year's audit, in that the regularity audits with regard to the financials reside under the Acting CFO's office. But what I have indeed done is established an audit steering committee, which is chaired by the Acting CFO. The members of that audit steering committee are made up essentially of the heads of the branches, the DDGs, plus other relevant support staff. And that audit steering committee meets every fortnight. I constituted the committee some 4 weeks ago. And it is through that committee where we will make sure that we clear issues to make sure that documentation is indeed available to the Auditor General on time and that we provide quality information to the Auditor General. So the Auditor General staff, both, they've got two audit teams, an audit team dealing with the main accounts and an audit team dealing with the audit trading entity. They sit on that steering committee as well, and they will highlight issues in terms of the work that has been done in the preceding 2 weeks that might require intervention from management if information is not forthcoming. So it does act as a clearing point, and the way the agenda is structured is that it's a two-part agenda, in that we deal with the main account issues with that team, and then we deal with the water trading account. So, Chair, that's the action that I've taken, and I'm confident that that action taken will result in a better relationship with the Auditor General's office and in terms of the documentation flow and availability of documentation on time.
Okay.
Bearing in mind, Chair, the documentation that is required does not only sit at national office. We've got 9 regional offices on the main account and 4 area offices under the water trading account where a lot of documentation would reside as well. So when the Auditor General does their audit, they actually go out into our regional and area offices as well. And we've got to make sure that we monitor and make sure documentation is available. I trust that suffices, Chair.
All right. Yeah, sure. But there's a continuous reference to the main account, which I assume is the department, and the water trading account. It's almost a separate entity, although it is called under the DG within the department. To what extent are problems that you're encountering in the
Chair,
water...
point of order.
You're dealing with it.
I'm dealing with that.
When he deals with it, will he please ask, do problems in the water trading account, problems their impact on the main account? Would he please ask that? Because I think it's already appropriate to ask it now, but never mind.
Okay.
My colleagues are not asking follow-up questions. Why is that?
You're on such a roll,
we want
your
observation. Yeah. I mean, must I stop and give them a chance?
No, continue, please. I kind of appreciate the fact that they are not interrupting you. Once you are done, they will definitely make follow-up questions.
Can I move on to the final aspect, and that's good governance. Governance. Governance, and a key aspect of governance is internal controls and the internal audit unit. And I want to turn to page 69, the audit committee report. And maybe, I think the chair of the audit committee is here, maybe they could also perhaps give an indication of how the audit committee is working. But if you look at page 69, there's there a list, a schedule of meetings, seven meetings, during the course of the financial year, all very well attended, except for the acting DG, who out of 7 meetings attended 1. Is it not a good idea, and this is another, not you, it's another acting DG, but is it not, as a matter of principle, a very good idea that the DG or acting DG indeed should attend these audit committee reports? That's the cold face. That is, there are many of the issues giving rise to qualifications first arise and are discussed. And it's a bit disappointing to find that the acting DG of then attended only 1 out of 7 meetings. Would you comment, and perhaps your own position as acting, are you attending these meetings?
Chairperson, responding to Honourable Ainslie, indeed, yes, I agree that it is not only a good idea, but it should in fact be put in practice that the head of department attends the audit committee meetings. I'm unable to answer for the lack of attendance by the former acting DG. Certainly, from my point, since I've been acting, there's been 1 audit committee meeting which I've attended, and the next one is scheduled for the 24th of March, which is next week Thursday, which indeed I will be attending as well.
You've got 1 out of 1 so far.
I've got 100% so far, Chair, yes, thank you.
Could you, or perhaps the Chair of the Audit Committee, tell us something about the Internal Audit Department? What is that? Who staffs that? Because in the report I'm referring to, your report, you do make some references to the internal audit function, and you say it lacked capacity. If you can just indicate, first of all, who is this internal audit? Or is it people from outside the organization? Just give us a bit of direction there, number one, and then speak about this lack of capacity.
Just in terms of internal audit department, it is an in-house internal audit department, and the person heading that department is actually here today. in the review of the total number of people that were to be employed, most of the senior people hadn't been employed. And that is the main reason for the lack of an ineffective or inefficient internal audit department. If you look at the current year, we had an audit plan that was approved by the audit committee, and that audit plan also hasn't been completed by the audit committee. By the internal audit department. And the main reason given for that was the fact that there was a learning process, and in my discussions with the head of internal audit, they still believe that there's issues with capacity. And the issues there specifically with the senior personnel within the department, that there aren't enough people to lead them in the compliance area and in the performance information area. So the prediction at this point is that going forward, unless we address the issue relating to the capacity, they won't actually achieve the audit plan as approved by the audit committee.
At the very heart of the organization, the heart of the problem of qualifications, you have a dysfunctional internal audit department. How big is this internal audit department? How many people are you looking at?
44 people.
Can we? Because
and why? I mean, why they're not being
shot?
Sorry.
No, I'm saying the head of internal audit unit is here, so maybe he can talk to the actual challenges that face their unit.
Okay, I'm the head of the internal audit. The year under review, specifically the year which I got appointed as the head of internal audit, and then during that year we then engaged, before my appointment, internal audit has always been understaffed in terms of capacity, and then the department took a decision to enhance internal audit capacity by creating the chief directorate and with three directors that will be responsible for the disciplines of internal audit, that will be investigation, compliance and performance audit, as well as the IT audit. And then the process started off by the appointment of myself as a chief director during that year. And then we then engaged in a process of appointing other staff members. Unfortunately, the process of appointment was concluded in the last quarter of this financial year, leaving us with no time to can be able to implement most of what internal audit is required to do. So in the years subsequent to that, we have moved as internal audit to try to implement most of our work. But as the chair has already indicated, as we are doing the work, there are certain challenges that we are experiencing, and then
what are the challenges?
Okay, one of the challenges is that when the structure was created, maybe the department could have kept in mind the fact that we've got two entities in one, which is the main account and the water trading entity. And we maybe should have within the chief directorate internal audit a specific unit that should focus on the water trading entity and the specific directorate that will focus on the main account. The same approach that has been used by the Auditor General to have specific unit within Auditor General focusing on main account and water trading entity. So that capacity challenge is something that still needs to be addressed within the organization.
Second one?
Just hang on. You have two audit committees. There are two audit committees, am I right?
It's only one, huh?
Yes, there are two audit committees. There's one for the main account of the department and one for audit trading. There are two.
Okay, just a moment. Let's get the acting DG to throw some more light.
Yeah. Just to clarify, Chair, there's one audit committee, and that's established in terms of the provisions of the relevant legislation, and that's the committee that is chaired by Ms. Shelley Thomas. Internally, in terms of managing the audit, I've established an audit steering committee, which runs on a two-part agenda. That's in terms of my governance arrangements internally in the department. The audit committee is the one that's established by law.
And then the internal audit?
Internal audit is also a requirement that an internal audit unit is established in the department. And the internal audit unit, if you look at the organizational arrangements, reports directly to the head of department.
Those governance arrangements we understand. I'm talking in terms to specific issues around capacity.
Chairman, in terms of looking at the organizational structure of the department, that's a process which we have initiated to move forward on looking at the structure. There are weaknesses, as Mr. Mapunga has pointed out, in that currently the audit unit is a single unit and not organized on the basis of looking at the main and the trading account.
What are we going to do about that?
Chair and I identified the weaknesses. It's one of the areas that we will address in terms of our organizational arrangements.
Okay.
Just in terms of...
Sorry, Chair, I was asking to say how, because this how has actually been unpacked as well.
Chair, part of the how is us looking at the entire organizational arrangement of the department, where we're going to do a broad business process re-engineering, looking at various...
When will that happen?
In terms of my undertaking to minister, that process is due to start from the 1st of April of this year.
To when?
I would want to have the results of the output of that exercise within a period of at least 3 months, but no longer than 3 months. So we'd be looking at the period from April through to end of June.
That's fine.
I need to correct a statement that's just been made.
Okay, it's fine. I'll give you the opportunity to correct. I think the question I'm asking it specifically in relation to internal audit and its capacity challenges. The broader issues around the governance arrangements in the department, well, that's something else that I'm sure the portfolio committee can and or will be able to follow up in your in-year interaction. Honorable Steele?
Yes, Chair.
No, is there something he needs to...
This relates specifically to the internal audit of the water trading entity. We've just been told that there's only one internal audit unit in the department and the entity. And the report says quite clearly on page 88, although WTE has an internal audit division.
Where on page
188 under 188. Governance, 188.
Just a minute, so that we're with you. Yeah.
Under governance, it says WTE has an internal audit division. The division did not have adequate personnel throughout this period. As a result, the following issues were identified, and you get internal control deficiencies. It sounds to me as though the WTE has a separate internal audit section. That's what a division means. And that is specifically inadequately staffed.
All right.
I'd like some comment on that, please, Chair.
Oh, that's fine.
Chair, if I could respond. You must bear in mind in the annual report we report on the two entities separately. But we are talking about the same internal audit unit. So when we talk of the internal audit unit under the main account and the internal audit unit under the trading account, it's the same internal audit unit that we're talking about. So the capacity problems which Mr. Mapunga has referred to relate to the fact that he does work on both the main and the trading account. I trust that clarifies it, Chair.
No, Chair, it doesn't at all, because I'm quoting from the AG's report, and the AG said he found an internal audit division for the WTE. Now, are we being told by the department that the AG can't count hits, can't assign labels, cannot recognize a division when it exists?
All right. Well, I don't know if there's anything further to what you've said that you can say, or if we have to check with the AG. I think he says no, it is the same people who do internal audit work for the water trading entity and also for the department.
This may be part of the difficulty, and that's why when Mr. Steele does his section, please answer the question, to what extent problems in the water trading account impact on the main account? So I think they do.
All right, that's fine.
I'm not finished. There's this blurring between the two, because it is confusing. In the annual report, the grammar used, they indicate there are two internal audit functions. You say no, there's one. And you say there's one audit committee, yes, but there are two reports in the annual report. It is very, very confusing. And I think if we are confused, I think that possibly the officials also are confused by a blurring of relationships between the main account and the water trading account. And that I think we've got to examine maybe when we look at Mr. Steele. But I want to come back, please, if I may.
No, I just want to get the auditor to assist us in tying down that part, and then you can continue.
Thank you, Chair. We need to apologize if the wording created confusion, because there is only one internal audit department that's responsible for both the water trading entity as well as the department. So they divide their resources to do both the entity as well as the department. Thank you, Chair.
Can I get back to this one internal audit department? I think earlier on the chairperson of the audit committee said it comprises 44 members. Did you? I think figure 44. And that what is the vacancy rate? We need 44 people to staff this unit. Is there a full complement of 44?
At the time of this report, it was 44. But while we have been affected by the issue of the transfer of the forestry function to the Department of Agriculture, Fisheries and Forestry, whereby it was required that part of admin staff that support or that is seen to be supporting staff needed to be moved over to agriculture. Then we had to relinquish about four positions. But at that point in time, it was a vacant position because internal audit itself of the department was in the process of being capacitated in terms of filling of vacancies. As I've already highlighted, during the first quarter of the financial year under review, we managed to fill all the positions that were vacant. However, as internal audit is a general problem in the government, there is rapid staff turnover within most of internal audit units of the department. In the process, we have lost some officials to other departments already. So I think
you have basically lost staff as you are feeling.
Yeah, that's what is happening.
As of now, there are vacancies.
We do have some vacancies, but progress is underway as per to fill those positions as well.
What is the current size of the unit and how many vacancies?
The current size of the unit in terms of the professional staff, I think I stand on that.
How many people staff this department? Is it now 40? If it's 40, what is the vacancy rate?
It is fresh now, as I've indicated, some have already left. And then I'm having about 36 officials, so a vacancy of 10% now.
When do you expect to fill these vacancies? Because you see, I doubt if you're going to receive an unqualified report the next time around unless you have a properly functioning internal audit department which reports to the audit committee, which reports to management. As long as that chain is broken, I doubt if you'll overcome these qualifications. So where are you going to fill those four vacancies? They're crucial. It's a very crucial department.
They are part of the recruitment drive that the department has engaged in to try to fill the positions.
But if you have a problem of turnover, if you don't address that problem of turnover, I mean, you'll be like trying to fill a leaking drum. What is it that's being done to try and address that problem of turnover? Acting DG? Because surely, unless you are able to stem the turnover process, we'll continuously have people coming in as others go out.
Chairperson, that's not only a challenge within internal audit, it's a challenge across the department where you appoint staff, they stay for a while and they move on. It's difficult to pin all of the staff down. I would request that my acting DDG Corporate Services just maybe talk to issues of retention. But with regard to the vacancies as they happen, when staff do resign, the heads of those divisions, in this case Mr. Mapunga, would be responsible to engage with our corporate services or HR to then make sure that the posts are advertised. But there's always a lag between the time that someone resigns and the time it takes to fill a post. So in terms of some of the investigations, we do contract staff in to do some of the investigations. And if you look at, I've had a look at the summary of the work that the audit unit is doing at the moment, and they've got some 119 investigations which are in various stages, 38 of them being complete, but notably 34 of those are being done by staff, sorry, not 34, 35 are being done by staff contracted in, where we lack those skills in doing forensic audits, for argument's sake. So we do, in terms of dealing with the capacity issues, also contract resources in to do some of the work. Thanks, Chair.
Right. Just finally, it's an observation. I thought you wanted somebody else to comment, but before he does, it seems to be an observation that there is a capacity problem across the entire department. If you look at, for example, pages 22 to 23 of the annual report, just on one program, water resources, repeatedly make reference to capacity challenges. If you look at those pages, 22 to 23, paragraph A, shortage of dedicated technical personnel. Paragraph E, shortage of personnel. Paragraph K, shortages in appropriately skilled staff. Paragraph F, a lack of technical capacity. There seems to be a major problem, Chair, in this department with regard to retaining staff and getting skilled staff, which again I think probably not only accounts for the financial woes in terms of the poor audit report, but probably also accounts for perhaps some of the service delivery problems and the achieving your objectives as a department, the lack of personnel, the lack of capacity.
Yeah, HR. How do we retain, or how do we deal with this challenge of turnover? Because if we don't, then it means that we will always perpetually have challenges of capacity, and it will result in some of this. And I suppose some of the workload of the internal audit arises from the lack of proper management at the top, so you have lots of deviation, which then increases the workload of internal audit.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, members. Just to position our capacity issues on our key
key areas of performance. For example, the area that we have concerns with, that we are dealing with in terms of our current recruitment process, where we are of the view that new appointees would be able to take up their posts the earliest the 1st of May, the latest the 1st of June, in terms of what we are currently doing from a recruitment perspective. On our key areas of performance, if we look at the NWIR, where we need capacity in terms of occupation-specific posts like engineers and scientists, our vacancy rate currently is only 11.3%, which is in the ballpark and even better than some of the departments in terms of our engagement with the DPSA. And our vacancy rate in IA, internal audit, is only 9%, which is also a result of turnover because there is competition for those skills. Even within government departments themselves, we seem to be rotating people from one department to another. In our policy and regulation branch, which is also key, the vacancy rate is also only around 21%. And I need to position it in terms of numbers. It's only 146 posts which we have advertised, and we are currently in the process of finalizing the pre-screening, and shortlisting will happen within the next 2 weeks. For our regions, which are meaning all the provinces and provincial offices in the 9 provinces, the vacancy rate is only 15.2% at this stage, and those posts have also been advertised already, and the panels have been approved to do shortlisting, and we are in the process of finalizing the scheduling and the screening as well. Generally, the total vacancy rate for the department as at the end of February is 15.5%, which when we aggregate it over a 12-month period, we are looking at reducing it to around 10% by the end of June in the first quarter of the new financial year. And when we look at the progressive recruitment process, we anticipate that by the third quarter in the next financial year, we should actually be around the accepted standard of between 10 and 12%. So on retention, we have made a proposal to the Office of the 18 DG, and it's been on the table and at top management, that we create a process of mentorship and shadowing. And we also have our graduate trainee program where we anticipate we will produce the required numbers of scientists, engineers, and technicians, as well as artisans, to plug the holes as we go into the future. But the current challenge now is that people apply and we circulate the same people in government, but we do have competition also from private sector. We have engaged with the DPSA, we have put our position, we looked at the market surveys, and there are issues that have been highlighted where we have to do our best in terms of competing and trying to retain the people. Okay. We've made discoveries that one of the main retention challenges is actually the packages, but they are not the beginning and the end. There's also issues around conditions within the department that we are addressing. And we have already tabled our proposals to the acting DG for approval. He has tentatively approved. We intend to implement from the beginning of the new financial year. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you.
It worries me. I don't know who establishes what is an acceptable vacancy rate. Because I would have thought that in a department like this, where expertise in terms of skills, engineers and so on, is absolutely vital, that when we say only, I don't like the word, only 21% vacancy, it is disturbing. But that's just my comment and my feeling. I think at some stage we need to look then at what is acceptable. Is even one vacancy, 1%, is that acceptable? I doubt whether a department like this can work effectively and efficiently with up to 21% vacancy rate in technical expertise, but that is something perhaps we need to look at another day. Chair, those are all my questions on those focus areas for now, but maybe later on if there's time, I'll have some general questions.
Thank you very much. No, indeed, Acting DG, you were indicating that you have challenges with the, you know, retention, but I think HR was putting it as, I was getting an impression, no, actually,
you have no problems with the, you know, your vacancy rates. It's within manageable levels. So your capacity to deliver should not fail on the basis of, you know, vacancies that you have. But the key issue for us is that management should be able to manage effectively and efficiently to ensure that some of these challenges that the internal audit and the audit committee have to deal with are addressed, not reactively, but proactively all the time. Thank you, Comrade Ensley Hosh.
Thanks, Chairperson. I think the area of reasons for qualified audit has been, you know, dealt with holistically. I'm sure you might have noticed that an overlap into goods and services has been, you know, occurring in between. So I would not, you know, waste much time on it, except to say the acting DG chair indicated to us that some kind of satisfactory steps have been taken to address the reasons why the department could not perform as would desired by ourselves. But this thing of not reconciling the monthly, you know, which resulted in goods and services being where they are today, what were the reasons for you not doing exactly that? But notwithstanding that, you have said huge, you know, challenges were caused by the former AG and acting DG, the DG and acting DG, which you are addressing it holistically. But it does not say we should not know why the reconciling of, you know, monthly as required by the law were not, you know, adhered to. What were the reasons for not doing that?
Chairperson, thank you. I'm going to once again just ask one of my staff to come in terms of history. And I would like to, I hope that I didn't inadvertently point fingers at any particular individual that preceded me. If I did, that wasn't the intention. I just indicated that I wasn't acting head of department at the time that the report was dealt with. So I can't judge on anyone else's management ability. I do think in terms of the goods and services, I indicated what we're doing in terms of the monthly reconciliations. And I'm going to ask both Philip Werter and, if I could, Chair, and Acting CFO Ntabi Singh Fundakubi, just to come in terms of just giving a bit of a historical perspective as to why it wasn't happening. If I may do so, Chair.
Well, I'm sure that when you came in and changed the system or the practice, you would have noted what was happening. And I think that's where it is. Why, I mean, where was the bottleneck? Why was it not happening? Was it that people did not know? They were not told? They were not follow up? Where was the problem?
Chair, that's why I wanted them to just respond on it.
Okay.
I picked up that there were indeed not monthly reconciliations being done, and we then corrected that situation. I must also just point out that after the audit reports, the Auditor General's report, that we did put in place a financial improvement action plan, which covered each of the areas of qualification assets through irregular expenditure, through performance information, where we identified the actions to be taken.
All right.
We also identified the people responsible for that and certain time frames to deal with that. So if I could ask one of my staff just to help me with that, Chair.
Okay.
Mainly the two contributing factors to the goods and services was on the issue of operating leases, and it was on the leases in terms of separation of capital amount and the interest amount. When it was captured as one account, as one amount, whereas it was supposed to have been splitted in between capital and interest. And other issues that has made a contribution was the inconsistency of transaction on the SCOA items. But those have since been corrected, and that's why the journals were passed. But to rectify the situation moving forward, we have the monthly trial balance meeting where all relevant stakeholders are meeting, finance, asset management, to rectify immediately when the inconsistency and the misclassification of items has been picked up. So on a monthly basis, that is done through the monthly trial balance meeting. Thank you.
Chair, I think if we were a portfolio committee, we would feel, you know, very comfortable with the reporting. But unfortunately, we are not. We are dealing with what has already happened. Hence, we wanted to know why were they not, you know, reconciled as it's supposed to. Why were you then, you know, misclassifying, you know, the leases as you were not supposed to? Those are the things that we wanted to hear. We don't, you know. I'm sure Hoshi Mateva there sitting, he is, you know, very excited that you are doing very well moving forward. But where we are coming from, you were not. Can you talk to where we were?
Where we were, it was the lack of knowledge in terms of how to do the transactions on leases. That it was various throughout the department at the regions, and as well at head office. But because of that, as I've indicated, we have since corrected because training was provided. But this was also picked up during the interim financial statement. And by the time we correct for the final audit, there was little time to correct the misclassification.
If I get the explanation, Chair, they are saying the reasons was that a department employed people who does not know how to do their work. But the unfortunate part is every month on the 15th, those particular people were queuing at the bank receiving their salaries for not doing the work that expected to be done. That is the unfortunate part.
What is the date today?
I'm not even sure. What is the date of today? I'm asking you. On a lighter note, maybe the fact that this book does not even have a picture of some faces, I'm not sure whether it's an omission or is it the way they're doing it. There's no, you know, both the executing and the accounting officer pictures here, because the ones that then authorized this document, hence we are running a bush. We are not even sure whether we are dealing with people who have, you know, authorized this document, or you are just another team of
the acting DG at that time is a miss. The current acting DG is there.
Do you see the picture, sir? Maybe in your report you might have the picture.
No. I'm saying yes, the picture is not there, but looking at the person who signed it tells you that it is not the same person who is here.
No, I'm checking why are they not, you know, in this report.
Wait until maybe Pretoria has come in. It might
be the one dealing with the picture.
No, not really. Well, okay. Well, if your position is the picture and not the person, well, that's something else.
Okay. I think one may not, you know, dwell much on the goods and service because it looks like they're acknowledging that they had no capacity at that particular time. It will be upon the committee to arrive at determination as to how do we then assist, you know, in our report as to what should government do to move away from this kind of challenge that we are having. The other area, Chair, is non-compliance. Non-compliance, Chair, I don't know because acting CFO earlier spoke about non-consistence when they are trying to do the things, while the reason why they did not comply, amongst other, is to fail to specify in a clear identifying the nature and the required level of performance. Which is what, you know, the department has been failing. Can we just get why is it difficult to comply with the laws that are governing the operations of the department?
Can I respond there first, in particular the item that appears in the AG's report? The non-compliance there relates specifically to the late submission of the performance report, which should have been, in fact, submitted 2 months after the end of the financial year, and it was indeed submitted after the two-month period, albeit that the Auditor General audit the performance report and expressed an opinion on it, but the non-compliance related to late submission.
I thought now that you know why you didn't comply on the basis of late submission, you'll tell us why did you submit late. I thought you were going there, but you are then stopping in between.
Chair, I hesitated because I wasn't in the seat at the time, I understand that it was submitted 3 days late, but late nevertheless. So that was the situation there, and I am not able to indicate, Chair, unfortunately, why it was submitted late. I must submit to that.
Okay. I'm getting confused because once the acting DG saying I'm unable to answer some of the questions, it's as good as he wasn't here. Because the fact of the matter is, acting now where he is, it's accounting on both, you know, the good and the bad of the department, whether he was there or not, because I guess in preparation to this hearing today, he had to undergo this particular report and have to identify areas that are, you know, going to be concerned as identified by the AG. May you please try to be open. Why were they late submission?
Yeah, I'm just trying to cross my mind back to the time. What is the reason for the late?
While they are consulting, Chair, this is exactly what I said he should have been doing prior to this hearing today, to say why were we submitting late, who was there, what happened. But asking here, it's a dereliction of responsibility in my own understanding.
All right, I want us to move forward, because if there's no specific answer here and now, when it's not there. But I think the point that the comrade is raising is that if there's late submission, it's either because, like you indicated, you have various offices. Information sometimes does not reside at head office, it resides elsewhere. Was there a delay in submission from the outlying offices to head office? Was there a delay in processing at head office? Because all of these will indicate to the area of bottleneck in terms of responsibility. If one area lags behind, then it has a knock-on effect on everything and everybody. And unless we're able to identify that, it means that come this audit end of this month, after April, you still find that somehow some of these bottlenecks will come out during the audit period, and then you have all this kind of delay. So it is identifying the bottlenecks within the system. This is the cause. That's why things were not submitted in time. This is what happened. So I'm saying that is the import of the question. It's not a frivolous question. Acting CFO, I thought you wanted to say something. No. Okay.
Chair, I understand that it's not a frivolous question, and I do submit that I don't have the response why it was submitted 3 days late, but I can indicate the action that I've taken to make sure that we aren't late with the performance plan for this year. In that, can I continue with the action we've taken this year, Chair?
Sure.
So, the business performance unit of the department has been carrying out this past year quarterly reviews on performance against the strategic plan, and with those quarterly reviews that are taking place, the roll-up of the final report to the end of the year, we will not miss submission within the 2 month period this year. So we've put in place steps through our business performance to monitor every 3 months, and in fact that report is submitted to me on a quarterly basis, and they are running now tomorrow and Thursday a session with all of our regions in preparation for bringing that the third quarter part of that report to conclusion and working towards finalizing the performance report for the 2010-11 financial year. So I've put systems in place with my business performance unit to make sure that we don't miss the 2 month deadline this year.
But in terms of treasury regulation, paragraph 5.2.2a required the department strategic plan to be consistent with their own published medium term expenditure estimate, which the department did not comply with. Can you share with us why were they not complying with that?
Sure, that's a criticism which has been made about our strategic plan, not only in the 9-10 audit year, but was made prior to that, I understand, and has also been raised sharply with us during the 10-11 financial year as well, when we reported to the portfolio committee. I can indicate the action I've taken in that. In terms of the strategic plan for the 11-12 financial year, we have made sure that there is a direct linkage of the estimates of national expenditure into the strategic plan of the department, and indeed that strategic plan for the year going forward was submitted last week. But I'm afraid you're going to find the same mismatch during the 10-11 year as well, as that was not adequately addressed. We do try in the quarterly reviews to make the linkage between the estimates of national expenditure and the strategic plan to ensure that linkage is in place. But, Chair, that's the action I've taken to make sure that going forward we don't have a recurrence of the issue that was raised by the Auditor General in both the water trading account and the main account in terms of that mismatch.
Were there any official who was responsible to have been caused the department to be inconsistent in terms of the treasury regulation that I've just mentioned? Or if the answer is yes, who was that official? What happened to that official?
Sure, the annual report is prepared collectively by the department and is then submitted under the signature of the head of department.
Are you saying what we have? I'm not sure whether earlier when you were saying
the head of department was is under suspensions, charged, and what have you found guilty? What was the same person that we are talking about?
Chairperson, the
I think maybe let's put it differently, comrade. I think in terms of the law, yes, the head of department is the person ultimately responsible of ensuring that all these elements and all these aspects are in place. So if there is non-compliance, it is the head of department who bears responsibility. And I would imagine that for the year under review, yes, the said official must have been responsible. If it was the other one, she's under suspension. It might as well be whether this will form part of the charges or not.
I would hesitate to discuss the charges here, if I may. But if you insist, I can certainly get Mr. Holby to refer to which areas have been covered in the charges.
No, it's fine. I think when we deal with item number 4 in our program, probably that's where it will be more pointed, because we'll be talking to some of the issues that have led to action being taken, what was the basis. And
I want to believe that particular section 4 is not going to deal with what I'm asking. What I'm asking here, it's somebody who was supposed to have been, you know, coining the strategic plan in line with the Treasury regulation, as I've quoted it earlier. And I wanted to know, if the person, it's the former DG, either being investigated, suspended, or whatever, it doesn't form any material issue here. The issue is the answer should be provided to us. Was this person, if part of the charges were related to the question I'm asking, sir?
All right. I think we do not have an answer to that.
Yeah, I'm trying to...
You see, comrade, my suspicion, born out of our experience, is that some of these transgressions, they don't seem to matter in departments. So they come and go and do not usually form the basis of any disciplinary measures being taken against officials. So it might as well be that we are raising the point that there is no Treasury regulation or any section of the law that is minor, for which there should be a transgression and there are no consequences, because it is this absence of consequences on these elements that then develop into a failure to comply on a whole range of things that then manifest themselves in bigger and huge instances. I think that's the point that he is emphasizing and bringing out, that in an instance where there is non-compliance, there has to be consequences. Because if there are none, then you're creating an environment where certain things are overlooked, certain things are acted upon, certain things are overlooked, just like that. And especially if it relates to senior management, I think that's where the challenge is. So I don't know whether indeed it forms part of the charges, but from where we're standing, we're saying anything that relates to non-compliance, there has to be consequence, there has to be action taken, whatever the action, but there has to be a sense that says non-compliance will not be tolerated, of whatever form, at whatever level. I think that's the point. Can we move on?
Excuse me, Honorable Chair, may I respond on behalf of the DG? The appropriate officials, and not just one official, there were 13 counts, all based on the question of non-compliance. And in particular to Treasury regulations, as well as the Department procedures regarding procurement. and deviation from the strategy. The Auditor General's office assisted us in terms of testifying in that process, and the officials, in fact, were found guilty. But apart from that process of a discipline which may have resulted in termination, the Minister has taken a decision to take it a step further and initiate criminal action against the individuals concerned, as well as engage the SIU for the possibility of recovering from the, through the asset forfeiture unit. So there has been some serious consequences as a result of these infringements. And these processes, unfortunately, are still pending in some legal forum. So we cannot actually disclose the nature of it, but I can assure you that, yes, they were charged on violations okay. of the Treasury regulations. Right. Thank you, sir.
I think that's all we needed. I seem to get a sense that suggested we're asking a question that was really not there. That's all we wanted to know. Have there been action taken against those officials who have not complied with National Treasury regulations? So, if that's how it is, then good. We're happy. That's what we want. Consequences for non-compliance.
Chairperson, I just want to go back to the issue of assets because I thought you were going to give us a chance after Honorable Ensley spoke, but you didn't. I don't know if I'll be relevant or irrelevant.
No, I think it's a good question. Okay.
Because he was through, the thing is that was just pressurizing the DG to say yes to what he was asking. At least you came to his rescue. Thank you very much. Chairperson, it's really not a question. I was listening to the department when they were talking about the asset register, the tangible, intangible goods and services. What I would like to hear from them is it that this year, 2010-2011, we are not going to find the issue of the asset again in the auditor's report. And going back to it again, I would like to know if the department is using consultants, if you are using them, on what are you using them, and how much is the department paying these consultants, and how long are they going to be used? Thank you.
Right. Carly, we're waiting for your performance audit report on the use of consultants in government. We don't know when it's going to come up. But anyway, Acting DG.
Chairperson, just in terms of the asset register and will it be an improvement during the current year, I did attempt in my earlier responses to indicate that we have indeed carried out the reconciliations, and I made reference to the CDs that I have available with the two asset registers on, but the proof of the pudding will be in the way the Auditor General views that asset register and how they pass their opinion. I would not be able to preempt that that situation. In terms of the use of consultants, in terms of preparing the asset register in particular, yes, consultants were used to assist us in the preparation of the asset register and determining the values that were assigned to the assets. Some of the assets we manage are quite complex engineering structures which need qualified people in terms of doing the valuations, and we don't have that residing in the department. What I'm not able to respond to, Chair, is how much was paid to those consultants. But I could submit to that unless there's one of my staff who are able to help me quickly with the amount. But we certainly did use professional service providers to help us to prepare the asset registers.
All right.
Chair, can I humbly request that I come back to you with that number? I don't have it on hand here. It's
I humbly agree.
Fine, no problem. Okay. Honorable Steve?
Thank you, Chair. The focus area that I'm looking at is the water trading account specifically, and I'd like to start with a fairly general question. Sorry, I now can't start with a fairly general question because the person that I want to ask has just left the room. So I don't know if anybody
ask,
else...
Ask it to the acting DG.
Yeah.
You'll definitely have the answer.
It relates to the issue of the capacity of the staff within this department. And we were told that the vacancy rate is close to Public Services Administration norms. It's 15.5%, which is close to the 10 to 12 range. And yet when I look at the audit outcomes for the water trading account, it looks to me like most of the problems come from capacity and leadership. And when it comes to capacity, some of the problems are in fact not of a very advanced or complex nature. So the first question I really want to ask you is, in relation to the WTE, now we know that the staff is integrated within the department, but I just want to be very clear. Does the WTE have any capacity or leadership shortcomings which the department as a whole does not? Because I get the feeling, reading the audit report, that the WTE is a bit of an orphan. Yeah, a Cinderella, even worse. And I need this perception to be put to rest, that this is not that the WTE is not being treated by the department as a whole as a place to put underqualified staff, poor leaders, poor managers, so that the department as a whole can look all right, but the WTE can look really, really bad.
There's no intention whatsoever to treat either one of the accounts differently, the one being treated as an orphan. As head of department, I've got to treat both accounts with equal vigor. You make reference, Honourable Steele, to the average vacancy rates in government, which is given by my acting DDG Corporate Services. But if you, in fact, analyze the financial component, finance component in the department, and that's an analysis which I've done since taking on responsibility as acting head of department, you'll see there that indeed. Now, you won't see because you don't have the figure in front of you. I've got the figure in front of you. I apologize. But the vacancy rate at the moment in the finance department is indeed 30%. So it is the highest area of vacancy in the department. One of the first steps which I've taken after consultation with Minister is that currently the water trading entity and the main account are managed under a single CFO. That CFO, as I reported earlier, is under suspension at the moment, undergoing a disciplinary process, and my colleague next to me, Ntabi Seng Fundagubi, is the acting CFO. The decision we've taken with Minister, and it's after my consultation with the Accountant General as well, is that we are going to split the two accounts. Although they're managed separately under the acting CFO at the moment, we're going to split them, that we have a separate CFO for each account. So that's a decision we've taken, and we've looked at a number of options to do that. in terms of the engagement I had with the Accountant General, one of those would be to try and seek very quickly to identify a CFO within government to come and take on that responsibility. That account is a trading operation, unlike many of the accounts which the departments operate under the on the BAS system. The second option was to approach FICO to see if we could get a retired accountant, a CA, to come in to assist us. We discarded that option because with all reference to older folk, but retired folk, I've got to try and find someone with energy and drive and who's not necessarily on the retirement program to come in and help me with a turnaround there. The third option is to look at using to delegate that function to one of our stronger entities, either being TCTA or one of our strong water boards. And the fourth option was to approach the private sector to see whether we could secure the secondment of a CFO. We have settled for the latter option, and the inquiry is out, and my return date is this Friday in terms of the five companies which we've approached, and we've approached five of the companies.
Secondment of a CFO.
Secondment of a qualified chartered accountant from one of the accounting audit companies to take on responsibility.
So it is hiring a company like Deloitte to run it. How different are the two?
We'd be hiring an individual through the company, but Deloitte wouldn't be appointed as such if it were Deloitte. It could be a KPMG, it could be a PwC, it could be a Cesar and Saliba, whoever it might be. While an individual would be contracted by that organization, they would, with the concurrence of National Treasury, be seconded to the department to perform that function. And that's the route that we've gone. I've had engagements with all five companies, some have already put proposals in, but the return date is this Friday, the 18th of March, to get those submissions in. So that's the first step we've taken. Now, in terms of getting that person in, we were done, albeit that as a management team, we've already looked at developing a straw dog or the bones of a turnaround strategy for the trading account.
All right. No, that's fine. Let's cut it right there.
Thank you, Chair. That's the kind of candor that we admire in this committee, and I'd like to thank the acting DG for that. It would have seemed to me, however, that having separate CFOs for each of these accounts was a fairly natural solution that could have been adopted years ago, rather than going year after year with qualified audits, with disclaimers, and with other harmful audit outcomes, because as we are constantly needing to remind officials in this committee, Chair, it's not just a question of non-compliance with a tick box. There's a very real chance that fraud and corruption will come in where the non-compliance becomes a culture within a department. And that is at the bottom of our concerns. But anyway, I would, as I say, just note of appreciation that the department is doing something about that. I think the separation into two separate CFOs is the way to go, and I look forward to each of them appearing at, if we have another hearing, to account for their separate sections. Can we go to some of the details of the WTE qualification? And if the acting CFO needs to add to what the acting DG has said, this would now be, I suggest, a good time to do it. Starting on page 185 with the problems of the suspense account. This is where I say that these things are not, you know, these are things that a competent financial management system would actually address. Accounts are not being cleared on a monthly basis. Monthly reconciliations are not being confirmed to confirm the balance of the accounts. And as a consequence, the AG cannot actually find to whom the money should or should not be allocated. So some explanation, please, as to how this was allowed to exist and then carry on and on and on.
Thanks, Chairperson. Honourable Steele did give me the gap to call on, with your permission, my staff just to back me up as well. But part of the cause of the suspense accounts is partly due to unallocated accounts due to the non-availability of reference numbers for the clients that we serve, which is an issue that is being dealt with, and also as a result of us not clearing that suspense account on a monthly basis. Action has been taken to make sure that the suspense accounts are cleared on a monthly basis, and those reports, since I've been acting head of department, have indeed been submitted to me. But if I could just ask Acting CFO to supplement on why it persisted.
Thank you, Chairperson. I think the Acting DG has covered mostly, but I think the significance of the amount, that is what has caused the seriousness of the qualification into the suspense accounts. But as the Acting DG has indicated, we are now driving to ensure that the suspense accounts are cleared and all unallocated items due to the clients that we could not get, we managed to make a follow-up on those billings. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair, because that answer now leads very naturally to the next issue that I want to probe, and that is the issue of the accuracy of the WTE's records when it comes to its client record, and the accuracy of the figures relating to what those clients owe. This is all to do with the water-related services revenue section to the accounts receivable section in the AG's report, because at the heart of the AG's concern is the issue of the accuracy of the records. Does the department know who owes it money? Does it go after people who owe it money? Does it let accounts become so old that eventually it has to write them off to the tune of hundreds of millions of rand in bad debts because the accounts have simply got so old? Worse still, Chair, does it have consumers who, because they know the department can't determine accurate figures for accounts, actually decide for themselves what they owe the WTE? Because that is what I suspect is happening out there. And when the AG's department tells me that only 4% of the debtors' confirmations that were sent out to debtors to confirm the amounts that were owed by them to WTE were returned. Okay? The AG sent out notifications to debtors to confirm the amounts that were owed. Only 4% of them actually returned that. And the confirmation showed significant discrepancies between the amount management discloses outstanding and the amounts the customers indicated as owed. And this is where I have this horrible suspicion that the customers are in fact determining what to pay. And at that point, we have no proper accounting and therefore no proper auditing of what the department is owed and what it should be collecting. And that's about as close to financial chaos as you can get, Chair. So please, can we talk seriously about the record keeping and the accounts owed and what the department is doing to correct this chaos?
Chair, thanks. Honourable Steele, once again, I am going to just ask for backup from my staff, but the issue of using information, the using information does not reside within finance. The using information resides within our WARM system, which is our water allocation registration management system. And that information is then on a monthly basis transferred to the trading entity who then issue the bills. And
sorry, Chair, we need to slow down on this one. We have a database of consumers, and every month that information is downloaded from that database and transferred to the financial management system, which presumably means that the systems aren't integrated, they're not talking to each other. This is beginning to get actually worse than I thought was possible.
Chair, that is correct. They are not integrated. So it's a manual linking that is done. So the WARM's database sits outside of finance, and the information is then downloaded from WARMS into the SAP system.
Okay. Continue, Phil.
I'm just writing very undiplomatic language, Chair, because we need to highlight this in our report. This is clearly an issue of systems not talking to systems, which we will need some report in the very near future as to what the department is doing to address. Again, are they looking to CETA, to some other service provider? But you simply cannot operate on this basis without the kinds of consequences that we are seeing here. So I think that we are going to need to flag that as an issue for our report, please.
Just a minute. You wanted to make some addition?
Sure, I just wanted to make an addition indicating that the training entity operates on a SAP platform, Enterprise Resource System, which was implemented in 2006, which was implemented, it went live in October 2006, and the system which we are using is already two generations old, in that updates have not been implemented on the system. I have an engagement which would have taken place last week had I not landed in hospital with the CEO of SAP Africa, just to see how we take forward the bringing our current SAP platform up to date. There are also a number of modules in that SAP platform which we have, like the utilities module, which were not activated. And I'm investigating now why those weren't activated and to see how we take that forward. So it is regrettable, Chair, that I have to come here and respond to work that's in progress as well.
I'm sure it would entail not only why it was not activated, who was supposed to have activated it, and then why it was not activated, so that if there's any malice, non-activation, what other avenues and possibilities does it open for people? You know, all sorts of possibilities that might arise out of that. All right. I'm sure that your progress in that regard will be monitored by the portfolio committee.
Yeah. Chair, just a specific aspect of this issue of the trade receivables. On page 208, 208 deals with trade receivables impairment provision. And it deals with individual assessments of those trade receivables, and then the one that I want to focus on, the collective assessment of trade receivables. And the entity, that's WTE, they risk categorize the balance of the trade receivables as follows, in terms of bulk, payers, companies, individuals, water service providers, water users associations. In the next paragraph, the collective assessment highlighted the fact that 60% of trade receivables assessed collectively that have been owing for over 150 days belong in the bulk payers category. The entity concluded that an impairment provision of 30% would be reasonable. The question here is, how do you have bulk payers who make up 60% of the trade receivables and owe for over 150 days? How is this possible?
Chairperson, thank you. Could I indulge you again and ask my acting CFO just to come in on that item as well? Can you come in?
Thank you, Chairperson. I think to respond to that, it goes back to a situation of closely monitoring of our accounts. And if we leave the account for long and not to attend such, it's possible that our big clients may have long days that we don't recover from them. Thank you.
They have noticed, seems like the understatement of the day. Clearly they are ripping you off big time.
Can I come in? Chair, if I could just supplement there, we did have a look at the risks related to that account, and the action that has been taken by management is in terms of the 68,000-odd consumer accounts that we do a more a reconciliation on those accounts. And currently the debtors' reconciliation and the reconstruction of those debtors in some instances, goes back to 2002. So that's quite a mammoth task that has to be done, and that's what we've picked up through our risk assessment. And the plans around the enhancement of the billing operations will ensure that the reliability of the customer accounts and that we eliminate the need for reconstruction of debtors' accounts, which is time-consuming, and that the allocation account managers for key customers that I'm looking at that as well. But part of the solution to that is the activation of the utilities module, thank you, of the SAP platform. So doing it by hand at the moment for 68,000 customers is by no means an ideal way of going about.
Okay, check. Let's move on, please. We're now on page 186. I'd like to look at the issues relating to regular expenditure disclosed in Note 27, which is on page 227 of the financial statements. Note 27, the following are items of irregular expenditure incurred by the entity. Movable asset project, services rendered without proper internal department approval. That was $4.2 million, then $1.8 million, realignment of roads, services rendered without proper internal department approval. Same thing again, Fourth one, services rendered without quotations, 434,000. And then the last one, a 27,000 overtime paid to employees without proper approval. All of these things, Chair, relate to weak control, weak internal control over decisions. And as usual in this committee, I would like to know what the department is doing to establish who is responsible in all of these and what is being done in terms of consequences for those people.
Chair, could I deal with the consequences first? And there were 1, 2, 3, 4. In those areas that are detailed in the WTE's irregular expenditure, in all cases, except for three, warning letters have been issued against the project managers who were responsible for those activities. The irregular expenditure was condoned by the acting head of department at the time. There are three that are still being dealt with, and the outcome of those, once they reach my desk, will determine how I take them forward in terms of giving warning letters or taking other action as well. But six of them have been condemned and warning letters issued. With regard to dealing with issues of irregular expenditure, if I could just indicate from a governance point of view that I have, I am in the process of establishing a risk management committee in the department. Essentially, once again, the branch heads will form the core of that risk management committee. But I have also invited three of our entities to nominate their risk managers to serve on that committee as well. And the three entities who have submitted names to serve on that committee are the TCTA, Mgani Water, and Rand Water. So I've instituted that committee, and it is due to have its first meeting within a week, I think. 17th, which is in fact Thursday. That committee will have its first meeting. What will be happening at that meeting, I will chair the first or open the first meeting, and then we'll sort out the chair for the risk management committee, and then I will step back, and that committee will report to me as part of the governance arrangements. We have, however, got attended to the control environment, in that I do now have in place a risk management framework, a compliance framework, and of course the governance framework, which have been considered by top management and will be taken forward into that risk management committee to see that we certainly improve on the control environment of the department. Thank you, Chair.
Perhaps this department chair might need to deliberate on whether the issuing of warning letters is actually sufficient, and whether there shouldn't have been some further investigation as to whether there were any conflicts of interest or whether there were any other reasons why the particular procedures were conveniently ignored in these particular cases. But again, I think that's something that we'd have to deliberate on.
Well, we may check. Was that investigated? Because clearly our sense sitting from here is that if a person decides to advantage a service provider over others by denying them the opportunity to compete, it cannot be it,
cannot necessarily happen innocently. So, warning letters in that particular regard is that substantive, sufficient response to this kind of deviation.
Chairperson, you're correct. Those warning letters were issued prior to my taking responsibility. But what we have done, and as Advocate Holby indicated in one of the earlier responses, most of these tenders form part of the package which we've referred to the SIU, and they will be part of that process. So whatever process evolves out of that, and if different recommendations are made or brought forward to us through that SIU exercise, we'll then react differently. But I've got the de facto situation where those warning letters were issued. I'm now investigating it through a different basis. And rather than investigating each tender internally on its own, standalone, we've put them all into a basket for the SIU to assist us.
Okay. All right.
It sounds like another engagement with the SIU that we're going to have to schedule, Chair. To actually get their report on this investigation. Just as a you know, a cynical member of SCOPA, as soon as I hear the word condonation in relation to irregular expenditure, I would question the condonation as much as the irregular expenditure, but that's just me. Thank you, Chair. Again, we are comforted by that assurance, and we look forward to hearing, obviously, what the outcomes of that SIU investigation will be. Can we go on then, Chair, to another matter under the WTE? It's significant uncertainties, and I'm well aware, as I mentioned this, it's on page 215 under contingent liabilities. It relates to Group 5 construction versus the water trading entity. I'm well aware that this matter is sub judice. It has not been resolved. If it has, then can we please have a report on the matter? But what concerns me is that the author of the annual report didn't stop at reporting that there was an outstanding issue relating to Group 5 construction in the water trading entity. I then went on to editorialize and actually said the entity is confident about its prospect of success. Now, by stating that, they actually invite the very obvious question, which would invalidate the whole sub judice provision. What on earth is the basis of this confidence, and should it have appeared in a report of this kind? Personally, I think it is inappropriate, and I would urge the department to think carefully about how they report on matters of this kind.
Yeah, I'm sure they've had your advice. They will think carefully going forward. Can we move?
Chair, I can't agree more with Honourable Steele in terms of indicating a liability and then passing judgment on a liability while it is still being investigated.
Yeah.
Can you indicate where we are with that investigation?
Thank you, Chair. The matter through our legal services is continuing. Obviously, with them, a particular the agreement on a court date is yet, Chairperson, so the matter is still sub judice. At this moment, I do not have the date in terms of when this matter will be heard. Thank you.
This Inyaka term, is the Inyaka term that's in Bushbuck Ridge? How? I see. Okay.
Right, Chair. Can I go on then, please, to the impairment of infrastructure assets, which starts at the bottom of page 186. We're talking about 446 million rand here, which has been impaired as a result of assets not being able to functionally perform as contemplated when they were initially designed, mainly because of limited utilization and loss of functionality due to siltation. I have a particular local interest in this chair, which I must declare, and that is that in my home municipality, we have a dam that is about to be sold. The department might know about it, the Hindley Dam, which has been in existence for decades. Many years ago, it was deemed to be impossible to manage, to actually obtain usable water out of it. It's used as the basis simply for the annual flooding of the Doozy, canoe marathon, and it's now about to be sold, I believe, presumably by tender. That is what I would call loss of functionality due to siltation. Now, I just want to know, Chair, how you build an asset without a plan to maintain it. And at what point in the process, down the line, 20, 30 years, at what point does somebody decide siltation has now reached the level where it's no longer economic to even think about getting rid of it? We now just write off the asset altogether or sell it to some private developer or whatever. So I'd just like some comment on the process which lies behind the impairment of these assets and how the department manages particularly the issue of siltation.
Yeah, personally, with your indulgence, if I could ask one of my technical experts to respond in terms of managing siltation. I'll ask Dr. Bratis just to come in and talk around some of the technical aspects of dam design and what they allow as dead storage for siltation, etc. I could speak to it, but he's the manager of the infrastructure.
Normally, thanks, Chairperson. Normally, about 5 to 8% of each and every infrastructure dams are provided for dead storage. And within the design of any infrastructure, you make provision for dead storage and also the aspect of siltation. And within the design of the dam...
Over what design last time?
I'm coming to that, honourable member. It's depending on the design span. Normally what we do design dams is particular plus minus 30 years that we design the dam. Also, in terms of that, we have to see in terms of what is the storage capacity on an annual basis in terms of the siltation, and then what is the loss in storage due to siltation. And then, obviously, we have to make a decision whether in terms of whether you can either lift the dam wall in terms of the to increase or to maximize your storage again, or you have an option of desiltation in terms of that particular infrastructure, so that you can then basically restore it to its original capacity. So that is normally in terms of the technical details that we do for the infrastructure in South Africa, and that is for all of the 359 dams that we do have on our asset register, because you also must make provision for those particular infrastructure in terms of the depreciation value for that, because over time then there is a decrease in terms of the storage and therefore the depreciation on that.
Okay, sure, thanks. I'm reassured that there is a kind of actuarial model for dams that seems to be being applied here. I guess this is the work for the relevant portfolio committee. We are simply looking at whether the department is modelling the investment and the maintenance and the depreciation and the write-off in a financially responsible way. But it just struck me that 446 million was an awful lot to write off in 1 year. So,
Chair, can I just come in?
Please. Chair, I'm nearly at the end, I promise you.
Okay.
I have finished because I've already commented on the WE internal audit. I would just highlight again, please, Chair, the issues of leadership that the AG mentions on page 187 and again on page 188. Under leadership, the oversight responsibility. An effective organizational structure that places people with appropriate skills has not been established. This was referring specifically to the WTE. And again, over the page, adequate financial management systems. Effective systems and management have not been implemented to ensure that all water-related services revenue was recorded in the correct accounting period. It goes back, Chair, to leadership and systems. And I really would not just urge, but we are going to require that this department report on exactly what it is doing to address those two very critical matters, leadership and systems. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Honourable Steele. I'm sure, DG, if you look at page 179, which is what the department itself has written about the entity, in terms of the challenges, report of the accounting officer, you realize that the first one is about skills. So if you don't have the skills, and then the second part being capacity around revenue management and financial management, you have a problem. If you don't have the system, you don't have the controls, and then there's a lack of direction in the management of the entity, then I think it creates a very, very challenging situation. And I think, looking back, those are the things that were grey, that these are difficulties that you would need to address to turn the entity around for the better. You want to make an addition to that?
Chairperson, thank you very much. I think in terms of those challenges, a number of my responses did touch on those challenges. But thanks for pointing them out and just highlighting them again. And the Chair, if I could just refer Honourable Steele to page 195 of the report in terms of the earlier question that he asked around the impairment and the life span of infrastructure. You'll see there, listed there, is the estimated useful life of infrastructure, running from buildings right down to tunnels, where you can have some infrastructure still operating for 300 years, which will be beyond my time. So that's the type of information that's taken into account in doing the financial modelling around how we manage that infrastructure and how we might have to replace or augment or raise the level of dams or increase capacity and do maintenance around the infrastructure as well. Thank you, Chair.
Okay. I hate to show off in front of Honourable Ainsley, but I would remind him that there are some Roman aqueducts that are still functioning today, 2,000 years later.
All right. Okay. Come to Chilwan.
Thank you, Chairperson. I've got a follow-up on the irregular expenditure, page 140.
And then we'll give Mutambi to ask the last question.
Two questions.
Sure, no problem.
The amount of 4.6 million, which was condoned by the acting DG due to some services rendered and they continue without the departmental authority. If maybe the acting DG could give us a clue to understanding what happened to these services which were rendered without the departmental authority. I don't know, Chair, if I could go on and ask the second one.
No, let the first one be responded to, and then I'll give you the opportunity to ask the second one.
If I could respond to those, it's a similar response to the one I gave in the question around the water trading entity, where the incidents were condoned by the acting DG at the time, and that warning letters were issued. So my updated information in terms of the notes I prepared for the meeting indicates that in those cases, warning letters were indeed issued as well. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson, to that response. The other question, I just want to go back to the revenue in terms of the SA statements of GAAP, IS 18. There's an amount which was returned to sender by the department. I think an amount of 201. But I was trying to locate it here in the annual report. I couldn't find it. But maybe one would want to know where did I find the information. But I think maybe the office of the AG could assist, because I found that information in the office of the AG. So I just wanted to check, in terms of finding out what processes is the department following before they write revenue back due to return to send.
That item is the one that appears on page 185 of the annual report. 185. The amount excluded is revenue 231,791.
How did we miss that? 185.
Oh,
yes, it's
182.
All right.
Chairperson, I did cover the issue of when I spoke about the risks that we've identified related to revenue and receivables, indicate there when I was referring to the linkage between WORMS and SAP while responding to the question to Honourable Steele. In terms of the RTS revenue, just to indicate that no return to sender revenue will be reversed in future, and steps are being taken to trace customers. Thereafter, an assessment on the ability to recover the money will be done. So we won't just be reversing, we'll actually go through that exercise of assessing our ability to recover. And we also have appointed, and I don't have the number in front of me, but we have appointed some graduate contract staff to assist within the water trading entity to deal with follow-up on the return to sender accounts. And that's part of our risk management plan that we have in place, Chair.
So it's just a follow-up on the just last part of the response in terms of the appointment of the contract staff. To check in whether if those contact staff are they working with someone so that they will leave the skills, the in-house skills in terms of dealing with the challenges that we might face with the department going forward.
Chairperson, in some instances when we take on contract staff, it's really to deal with the volume of work that needs to be done. So they would work under the guidance of a manager within the trading entity, but we really take them on to be able to deal with volume. you might very well find that some of those contract staff might find their way into some of the vacant posts that we have. But essentially it's to deal with backlogs and volume.
Okay. Kumbuz Ndambi?
Thank you, Chair, for giving me the opportunity. Okay, fine. 140. The irregular expenditure. 140, note 26.2. I see the only action that has been taken is with regard to the first one. Can we, because I don't think it's related to the other irregularities. 140, sir. Yeah. Yeah, I see the only action was only taken with regard to the first one. Yeah, and then what about these other ones? I know it's separate from the report that the AG has prepared on the other procurement irregularities. So these are, can we be told what happened to this other one? Because an irregular expenditure remains irregular and action must be taken in terms of the PFMA.
Chairperson, while at the time of preparing the annual report, that detail wasn't, or action hadn't been taken. Since the annual report, action has been taken, and I can provide you with that schedule with the details if you so wish. But action has been taken, and there's remedial, an indication of the remedies in those cases. So there is an update on that table.
Yeah, no, that's fine. Can we get it, say, by next week, Tuesday? All right.
No problem, will you take
that? Okay. Next week, Tuesday, fine? It's fine. Ah, okay, all right. Yes, comrades.
Second one is on HR matters. I can't see anywhere in the report where in...
Which page are you referring to?
No, I don't have a page. I want the DG to assist me.
Oh, okay. I thought Pretoria would be helpful.
Yeah, on HR matters, because I always thought...
You are consumed by campaigning.
HR matters. We just want to check if there's anyway. Anyway, there were payment of performance bonuses to SMS, the senior members of management. I'm raising it based on the status of the current report before us. Can you assist us with regard to staff payment, maybe?
Chairperson, in relation to the report that's before you, no, there have been no payments as yet. I will be dealing with the moderation of the assessments in about 2 weeks' time. So I can say at this stage no one has received any benefit from the report that's before you.
Can we look at page 124? I got it. There's performance award there. Note 4.1, compensation of employees. Page 124, 4.1, salaries and wages. Number 2, performance award. And the figure is attached there.
What is the figure?
It's 12.
12 million?
Yeah, 12,676 million. What is it for?
Chairperson, those performance bonuses were paid in respect to work done in the previous financial year, and you'll recall that the previous financial year did have a better report than this one. My initial response was around performance bonuses related to this particular report.
Oh, yeah. No, you're correct. In relation to this report, the work done, which was referring to this report, the assessments will be before you in 2 weeks' time.
4th of April.
The 4th of April is the date that's set.
Okay. All right. Your last question.
Yeah.
As they were reporting on the processes of the former DG, they indicated that there's been a dismissal and then a dispute. Is it in relation to the dismissal or something else? Hence, we appreciate the effort of consulting the SIU, whatever, but that's one item I couldn't understand.
Jefferson, can I field that one straight to Advocate Holby, if you would indulge me, if I could?
Very narrowly. Where is the dispute?
In respect to the dismissal, Jefferson.
All right, thanks very much. Pretoria?
Thank you, Chair. I just say to you, Chair, despite campaigning and finding overwhelming support for my party, I have prepared a focus area. My focus area relates to the special investigation report into irregularities with procurement. Now, there are five contracts at stake here, which I will come to in due course. Can I just refer to what the Auditor General found as the root cause for this? As part of his findings, the Auditor General says the following. The findings in this report should be addressed decisively by the Minister with the support of the senior management. However, corrective action limited to the specific individual findings alone would most likely address the symptoms but not the underlying causes. This approach carries the risk of deficiencies recurring in future. It is therefore imperative that the underlying causes contributing to the deficiencies be properly understood and addressed as part of the corrective actions. Now, obviously, my interest lies in what happened in the past with these specific contracts, but more so with corrective measures. What is the department doing now? What has the department done since then to avoid a similar situation happening? Then the AG says the underlying causes can be summarized under three headings. The one is quality of reporting. In other words, there are no records kept and things like that. The records are inaccurate. Effective governance arrangements. He refers to things like internal audit committees, enterprise risk management, fraud risk management, internal control frameworks, etc. And then the third one, and it ties up with what my colleagues have said before, adequate leadership oversight. And this to me is the core that I want to address, the core reasons why we're sitting here with a report full of, with a big stain on the department, if I can call it like that. The AG says this category underscores the importance of leadership creating the correct environment in the organization. It includes the manner in which leadership monitors performance and compliance and the way in which ethical behavior is promoted. Leadership oversight is also about preventing an organizational culture of impunity and acting decisively to correct deficiencies. Now, we've heard before that there are certain actions being taken to certain role players who were involved in these actions. Now, it's a pity, sir, that we're talking to the wrong people here. The people that I wanted to see today here would be the former DG, Mrs. Yaku, the acting DG, Ms. Ngele, and the CFO, Mr. Ayaya. Those are the persons probably implicated in the report, and they are not here. So I'll be asking questions of people who worked with them, who were joined subsequent to them leaving, but I still need responses. And the key person that I think also needs to explain something to us is the former Minister of Water Affairs, Mrs. Minister Sonjika, and the Deputy Minister as well. The AG talks about leadership and about oversight and the responsibility of ensuring that things go correctly. Now, to the credit of the Minister, when she was handed the letter to say to her that there are things wrong in this department, she acted, and the first step was to suspend the then DG. But, sir, I think ministerial oversight should go much further than that. The Minister should have been aware that there's something major wrong in the department, and the Minister should have been more hands-on involved. I want to refer you to page 9 and page 10 of the report. Minister Sonjika, and I'm sorry I have to say that, but it's in the report, it's public knowledge. She was appointed in May of 2009 as the minister. And immediately she started traveling overseas. For the rest, the remainder of that year, she was away for plus minus 100 days, while Rome was burning, in a sense, in the department. And not to be outdone, the deputy minister did the same. The deputy minister was away for 85 days, visiting 13 countries. The minister visited 16 countries. Maybe there's value to be added by the trips, I don't know, but I doubt that. My plea to the current minister is therefore not to do the same, but to really be hands-on involved in the department. And I'm not saying the minister must do the DG's work. The minister mustn't interfere in the DG's work. There's a function of the DG on the administration side, but certainly there must be healthy interaction between the DG and the minister, oversight from the political side to ensure that what the department should be doing is actually happening. And I know, it didn't happen in the past, and that's why we're sitting with this report. So that was my introduction. Can I get to the specific findings? This non-compliance with procurement regulations and all sorts of regulations led to the irregular expenditure of almost R1 billion, just on 900 million rand irregular expenditure. And the bulk of that money is the first one, as I want to refer to, that's the IT contract with a company called Ariba.com.
$786 million. I'm failing to resist this temptation to try and check with you in line with your opening remarks, seeing that the 3 plus 2 people who would very directly and in detail talk to the specifics of those issues are not here. Maybe a bit of a deviation from the norm. Out of all these things that are there, that have been reported in May last year, or in March, what is it that has happened in relation to this report? And maybe a response to that question could then allow you to then go into other elements that you feel have been left out or that are grave. If you find it that we can go that way, but if you want to go in terms of what you have prepared, I would still allow you to.
So we can do that, except that we already know what happened. We heard from the advocate that certain disciplinary hearings were held, people were found guilty, and criminal proceedings are now following. So we know that there's a process going on. I'm quite happy with that, and we commended the department for doing that. But there are specific individual questions that I still want to ask. For example, under the Ariba.com one.
No, it's okay. Continue.
What happened in this case is that the company got a contract with the department for a specific period, and then it was extended in contravention of regulations for a couple of months. In fact, the original contract was worth 180 million, and eventually ended up as an amount of 1.056 billion, 587% increase instead of the 50% which they were allowed. So certain things happened there, and that's now the topic of further consequences. But the interesting thing to me is that they entered into this contract with this company without signing a contract. There was no signed contract, or the AG couldn't find a signed contract. Now, my question is that still this now the situation that signed contract was never found? Is that still so? My first question.
Was the contract ever found subsequent to this report?
Chairperson, that contract, as far as my knowledge goes, is signed and is there because, in fact, the Rivia have since been taken over by T-Systems, and in terms of that takeover, those contracts had to be ceded on a legal base, and they couldn't be ceded unless the contracts were in place, and that exercise was concluded towards the end of last year in terms of the cession of that contract to the new owners, T-Systems.
The AG says that all the information was there, but the information came from an unsigned contract. But obviously the Revo.com might have had their own contract which was signed. Just the department has lost their contract. But be it as it may, can I then ask, what's the current status? You say the company has been taken over by a different company. Are they still contracted to the department?
Chairperson, if I could respond to that, I'm just looking for the date. The contract expires in August this year, September this year, sorry. I was a month out. The current contract, and as it's been ceded to you with the new company, T-Systems, runs out in September this year. And we've already put in a process to procure the services of a contractor to carry on the services which we are being performed by T-Systems, as they are now called. And our target date to start that handover process, subject to all of the engagement that we have with CETA, who are involved in looking at our business process, our business plan for the engagement of an outsourced contract, and also our governance model for IT, is that the handover, the transition period, if all goes according to plan, would be from the 31st of July this year. So we've instituted that procurement process to replace the current contract.
All right. Can I just get the confirmation from the acting DG that contract will not be extended on a month-to-month or 6 months back as the previous one which led to this finding?
Chairperson, I would not fall into the same trap. That's why we've put a process into place to get a new contract on board by September when the contract expires. And you'll note that I'm indicating that the new contractor must be appointed before the other one expires, that we can have that transition period for the handover. And that's the plan we have in place, and that, Chair, is the plan I intend to stick to.
Right. Thank you. If I can carry on to the second company involved, the appointment of Solexperts AG for the upgrading of the Trivex surveillance system. Now, what happened there, the AG says no significant deviations from the supply chain management processes were identified, except again that the department could not provide the contract. I presume the signed contract. Is that, what is the current situation? Has the signed contract come to the fore?
Chair, I'm getting a shake of a head next to me which indicates that the signed contract has not come to the fore. Tavi Singh, do you want to respond to that?
At the time of the investigation, going through to the records of the department, the documents could not be found where the signed contract was in. So the situation is still the same.
My question is to try and rectify or to avoid a similar situation from occurring again. How do you deal with contracts now after they've been signed? Is it the function of the legal services to keep it, or does the accounting officer keep them? What happens in the
Chairperson, if I could come in, I'll ask and Tavi Singh, in her role as Chief Director of Supply Chain Management, to respond to that as well. But the contracts, the custodian of those contracts would be with Supply Chain, but I'll let her respond to you personally.
The situation has since been corrected in terms of the management of documents, in terms of contracts. Once the contract has been signed, the records are kept at supply chain management, and we have also introduced a system where we track the contract management when it's expired, then the project manager is being informed on time prior to the expiry of the contract. The, in terms of the documents, the supply chain becomes the custodian of the contract.
Last question on this score. Are there any other contracts missing which the AG didn't even refer to currently in the department?
Auditable contract. If I could, you know, it's difficult for me to respond to an issue which is not, but let Tabi Singh just respond.
It's difficult to answer the question, but to answer and to respond is that, yes, there are some of the, not contracts per se, but some of the missing documents within the files of contracts.
This is a serious problem. What happened to them? Did some of those documents disappear with previous employees, or is it just a matter that they were mislaid somewhere? Or filed wrongly?
Can I just respond? Chair, when we, you know, some of the files, when we find documents are missing, is that when we're trying to do discovery in terms of investigations, and even in terms of some of the investigations that are being performed right now on as part of the disciplinary processes, we find that some documents go missing. I suspect that documents are intentionally mislaid. That's what I suspect. So through supply chain, they try the best they can to reconstruct those documents. But I think that my suspicion is that those documents are deliberately mislaid.
Yeah, I suspected that too. Can I get to the third case? That is the appointment of Dr. Olver for the change management project. Now, Dr. Olver, as far as I know, was a former Director General of Water Affairs, so he was known to the environment and tourism. The AG found that an amount of 289,000 rand was paid before the contract was signed. So, again, I don't suspect that you can respond to that. That's a transgression. It shouldn't have happened. The total amount of the contract was 1.187 million rand, which was a huge contract. The transgression, amongst others, was that when she was found guilty, the AG, the DG at the time, senior managers should not allow themselves to be properly influenced by personal relationships. Can I just repeat that for the purpose of the accounting officer? Senior managers should not allow themselves to be improperly influenced by personal relationships. They should recuse themselves from any decision when there might be a conflict between their personal relationship interest and the public interest. Now my question is, what is the current situation in the department? What does the department do to ensure that, apart from managers declaring their interest generally, what does the department do in the case of a contract being signed for making sure that there's no clashing of interest?
Chairperson, in terms of the supply chain management procedures, when tenders are called and are evaluated, every member of the panel, an evaluation committee for a particular tender, has to sign a declaration. And if indeed there is any conflict of interest, then they would not be part of that evaluation committee. So they would have to declare interest up front and then withdraw from that panel. But every member, and if you have a look at the files, as we keep the documentation for particular tenders, all of those declarations for individual panel members would be on the record.
Thank you, sir. The fourth one is the appointment of PISM, Program Impact Systems Management, for the establishment of a women's organization and the hosting of a Women in Water, Sanitation and Forestry Awards. Now this, went before a tender process, and the company by the name of Batseta Consulting was found to be the preferred bidder. And then there were requests made to the bid adjudication committee that another company called Z-Zone be given the contract. And then when Z-Zone brought the proposal, there wasn't a tax clearance certificate. And then the bid adjudication committee resolved that a new process should be followed. But that did not happen, and the department, without a bidding process, requested the final company, PISM, to submit a proposal. Now, on the face of it, it looks rather fishy. Now, my question is, what's the reason why PISM was so favorably seen at that stage? Was there a link between any of the senior officials and PISM, or was it just a matter that their proposal was so much better than the others to come in at this late stage?
Person, I would, if I could indulge you again, just ask Advocate Holby to come in relation to the disciplinary process.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. Honourable Pretorius, that was exactly why we charged the DG. We asked the very same question, and she was unable to answer it at all, and as a result, she was found guilty of misconduct. Unfortunately, the scope of our proceedings were limited simply to the violation of the process, but in terms of any type of additional benefits that may have ensued, they are subject to the investigation with the SIU at the moment. Thank you.
The sole director of this company is a lady by the name of Maria Nkumane. Does that ring a bell in the department? Did that person render services to the department in some other capacity before?
The person where I'm sitting, no, it doesn't ring a bell.
My final question, I presume this is also a question that you might have asked her. Why was the amount increased? The proposal was for 3.8 million, but eventually the company was paid 4.1 million. Is that the explanation for that?
Chairperson, those are the exact issues which we hope to find out through the next stage of our investigation. So I hope to be able to give you a more definitive answer once we've taken that process through to its logical conclusion.
So I've come to the last one, and it's not a long story. It's again about the appointment of travel agencies. Duma Travel, Connex Travel, and Sure Travel, Sure Flywell Travel. It appears that the then DG interfered in the process by appointing a different bird adjudication committee, presumably on the face of it, to get to a specific outcome, which she might have achieved in the end. Is this also part of the criminal investigation against her?
Yeah, that would also form part of our investigations, but if I could also just indicate that the contract for those three travel agencies came to an end in December 2010, and through a procurement process, we do have a new travel agency in place dealing with our travel affairs in the department. Thank you.
Chair, that would conclude my part. If I can just confirm again what I said in the beginning, that I still believe that there needs to be stronger ministerial involvement in this department to ensure that the train remains on track. And I suspect the current minister is doing exactly that, and I hope she will confirm that. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Thank you, Pretoria. Wow. All right. I'll give you, Honorable Singh, Comrade Mateb. My understanding is that the chair could not be here, so you are here in his deed. What we do and which will afford you is an opportunity to talk to any issues that were raised throughout for 1 or 2 minutes before we allow the minister to talk to any issues that she might have observed. So I'll give these comrades and then I'll come over to you. Sing, and then Hosh Tobijan. So there's no confusion.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. I think it's quite laudable that action was taken against the former Director General and all these interventions were made. Otherwise, there could have been greater losses to the state, notwithstanding the fact that there has been great loss already. What I'd like to ask is the three questions, quick questions, is we were given a list of directorships of one company, Arriviacom, if you pronounce it correctly. Now, from your investigations, were any of these people who've been listed here or anybody that had a contract with the department linked to the department in some way or the other? Were they employees of the department at some stage? So that's the first question. The second question relates to, if you don't have a signed contract and you can't locate the contract, how do you pay? Isn't payment on the basis of a contract a legal document? So how does one pay somebody if you don't have a contract? And the last question, Chairperson, is the whole issue of consultants and appointment of consultants. Because when I look at the annual report, you'll see on pages 274, 275, 276, 277, a whole list of consultants that are appointed, providing different services, and one could understand that the department will have to outsource certain specialist requirements because you don't have in-house capacity. But it's 115 million rand worth of consultants that were hired out by the department. We don't have a list. We have the projects. We don't have a list of the consultants that were hired, and maybe this committee needs to know who were these people, because there were 72 service providers, so that we can see where they are. And what? Why is in-house capacity not being found or being developed in some of these areas of expertise? Why do we have to continuously go out to these consultants? 115 million rand a year is a lot of money for consultants. Thanks.
All right. I'm sure, DG, that can be provided to us.
Chairperson, if I could just deal with them in the reverse order, certainly we can provide you with a list of the consultants. I must just also point out, and I think it's more relevant to the trading entity, that the list of consultants, as they are reflected there, some of those are actually contracts for projects. They get grouped together under that same banner. In the annual report, which we will prepare for this past financial year that we're in, we will separate out and identify contracts where we are building infrastructure as opposed to professional service providers, consultants, who are doing consultancy services. But we can certainly provide that list to you, Honourable Chair. And there are a number of services which we will, even if we had 100% of our organization filled, that some specialist services would have to be contracted out. So I don't think we'd ever get to a point where we would not use service providers at all. But I think the high level that's reflected there is also a reflection of the current vacancy rate in the department. I'm not aware of any of the directors of Arrivia having links into the department, but maybe from supply chain management, and Tabi Sen can help me. And I'm also going to ask her just to help me on that question which Honourable Singh has raised around how do you pay without a contract.
Thank you, Chairperson. In terms of which question, the one of payment to without the signed contract, if any payment goes through with the unsigned contract in place, then that becomes an irregular. If such expenditure has been incurred without any signed contract, that becomes an irregular. And as a department, we cannot pay without any signed contract.
And in the case of Arabia perhaps, in terms of the contract, the master agreement was signed, and therefore it was used to make payments of the expenditure. In terms of the directorships of Arabia linked with the officials, that we don't have that information as yet. Thank you.
Okay, just to follow up. I can't understand this master contract thing. You know, if there's a master contract, then you can pay. I mean,
yeah. Develop your question.
No, I thought you'll respond to that. I can't understand what it means. There is no contract. You can't find it. It's nowhere to be found. People are still being paid. And on what basis do you pay? There has to be legal tender. There has to be a document. There has to be something. I don't know how Treasury would allow this. And if it's irregular, it's irregular.
Chairperson, in terms of Rubia contract, there is a master systems contract in place. And then the work that's provided is then also provided by various service level agreements between the various business units in the department. So I did respond to that earlier on, indicating that with the ceding of the contract to T-Systems, that those contractual arrangements have been attended to.
I think maybe I'm missing some of the details. I think in relation to Arabia.com, I think that's how the company was called, it was more the deviations that were at issue beyond the policy prescripts of the department. Hosh?
Thanks, Chairperson. I think mine is some kind of a general question to say, you know, receiving this AG's report through after going through the investigations and forwarded to you with a massive, you know, recommendation. May you be able to say at most, at what level are you in implementing the recommendations of the AG? I'm aware that those that are related to criminal, you know, cases, you are at an advanced stage, you are doing well. But I wanted to check at, you know, the general implementations of the AG's recommendation, part of course, looking at the irregular expenditure that has been pointed in many of the contracts that you have been, you know, entered into.
Chairperson, in a way, I have responded to those issues through some of the other questions, and it relates to some of the high-level issues raised in the report around quality reporting, effectiveness of governance arrangements, leadership oversight. And, Chair, I've tried in my responses to indicate what interventions I've put in place with regard to the governance arrangements. That's not only with regard to my own two-weekly top management meetings, but it's around the risk management committee. It's the actions I've taken with the replacement of the departmental bid adjudication committee. It's in relation to the investigations that are being conducted by our internal audit and actions being taken around those. And I believe that we've taken fairly substantive steps in making sure that we address some of those weaknesses that have been identified through the Auditor General's report. So certainly the team that are sitting here with me are under no illusions as far as their responsibilities are in terms of providing leadership and oversight into the department in dealing with these matters. I already have a report from the interim DBAC indicating to me, Chair, some of the weaknesses that they have identified through the supply chain system, which as they identify them, we go through and deal with them. Issues such as training, lack of project and program management expertise in the department, and we need to put in place interventions to deal with those. I've already identified some areas where there has been unauthorized expenditure, dealing with that and elevating it to me to deal with. So I think in terms of the governance arrangements we've put in place, we are certainly trying to stop the bleeding in the department.
Okay. Maybe just a follow-up chat. Holistically, do you have a target period to say, at this particular time we wanted to be sure that we have, you know, implemented holistically what the AGF recommended us to do? Do you have an idea of that target time frame?
Chair, it's an ongoing exercise. I've got to plug holes as we pick them up. So we plug the holes which have been identified in the report, and the AG doesn't always pick up all the holes either. You know, much of their work is done on sample survey or sample basis, and they won't pick up all of the holes. We won't pick them up where the AG doesn't pick them up. And that's really some of the governance arrangements and the internal audit issues that we deal with. I deal with a lot of anonymous calls. I deal with calls that are logged through the presidential hotline, where we have to identify things which we might not be aware of. Get those coming in, we then investigate them and we take action. So Chair, it's an ongoing struggle to deal with fraudulent activities and aspects where individuals try and bypass the control measures that are in the department. So certainly from where I'm sitting, the intention is to take very quick and decisive action on all of the matters. I've got in fact, when the issues are raised with me as well, once I've taken action, I also keep Ministry informed of the actions that are being taken as well. So on, I would say, 100% of the actions that I've taken, a minister is certainly aware of those actions being taken as well. So it's done on a consultation basis also. Thank you, Chair.
Okay. I wanted to stop with Comptroller, but now, okay. Comptroller, then Pretoria, wait a minute. You want to ask that question? No. Okay.
Well, it's a new question entirely.
Okay. Another fine.
Chair, throughout the annual report, there is no reference to asset mine drainage. Now, I know it's something that cuts across all departments, minerals and energy and other departments, but it also falls clearly squarely within several of your programs. For example, Program 2 talks about protection measures of water sources. Now, I'm wanting to know that, do you envisage any costs, any expenditure going forward related to dealing with this problem? Because you are part of an interministerial task group, and I want to know the tasks you've been given in that interministerial task group. Do you envisage any expenditure in dealing with asset mine drainage? And the second question is, we follow the principle in our law of the polluter pays. And I want to know if you've ever considered legal action against directors of these mines causing acid mine drainage.
Chairperson, yes, it's not in the report, but I can certainly indicate that we have a role to play in dealing with the AMD, and yes, there will be expenses going forward. Some of those expenses will be covered on the budget of the department in the 2011-12 financial year. And in terms of the decisions that have been taken by Cabinet, the decisions were taken on the caveat that we would also be exercising our rights in terms of Section 19 and Section 20 of the National Water Act in terms of trying to recover some of the costs of that intervention that would be put in place.
Mr. Dollar? And then Comrade Dambi.
Can I just get clarity or confirmation that in the pursuance of the case against the former accounting officer that she would be prosecuted in terms of the PFMA, Section 38 of the PFMA? Because that, to me, is the way to go if you look at these transgressions which the Auditor General found. So Section 38 gives you the whole list of the responsibilities of accounting officers, and failure to do that is stipulated in question in Section 86, which tells you what should happen to that accounting officer. So my question is, are you pursuing a prosecution in terms of the PFMA as well? Because that is important to us.
Chairperson, could I ask Advocate Holby to do that? I'll just go to the Shire Market.
Honourable Chair, Honourable Pretorius, you are absolutely correct. We've not only pursued Section 38, but several other sections of the PFMA, as well as several violations of the Treasury regulations as well. Thank you.
All right.
Thank you, Chair. It's a follow-up on what you just raised, Comrade Pretoria. It seems as if the focus is on the then DG, the two DGs, and the Chief Information Officer. And this thing is a chain, because I've heard them saying we have just changed members of the BID committees, we have replaced them. And also these former members of the then BID committees. I think they had a stake on this. So dealing with the top structure won't be a solution to the problem. What's happening to these other officials who are there within the system? We are also implicated, because this is not a job of 3 to 4 individuals. It's a whole lot of HP. We want to understand what's happening to these other officials who are there who are also implicated, because since the engagement, we are hearing about this top brass and we don't hear anything about it, because they are professionals like your accountants. I think they should be able to advise senior management. But if they fall part of this, I think action is to be taken against them. Secondly, Department of Water Affairs, if you are to look at it, we have it last year. You see, you find a situation where people resign from the department and they again become consultants of the same department. That's rife in the department. I think last year we asked the DG, the then DG, to say we need a list to say how many employees were employees of the department. They are now consulting in the department. Also, we asked about the issue of the police. Don't you have a cooling period to say if I resign, then for this period of years, then I'm not supposed to contract? Because majority of the people who are doing work, these consultants you are referring to, they are former employees of the Department of Water Affairs.
But can we have a response?
Honourable Chair, my response will be limited to the first question and allow my colleagues to follow up on the second question.
Yeah.
On the 23rd of November last year already, we informed 8 other officials who form part of the Departmental Bid Adjudication Committee that they are in fact also under investigation. We currently have outsourced some of those investigations to external auditors are performing an audit on that work through, and also through our own internal audit department. So you're quite correct, ma'am. The action is not just limited to the top management, but it's now cascading to the level of other officials. Thank you, ma'am.
Okay. The issue of consultants, the fact that a good number of the services who are engaging are people who are working in the department. The HR wants to respond to it.
Thank you, Chair. On an individual basis, we do not currently have any previous employees who are coming in as consultants themselves. But on the specialized fields, for example, in construction, there may be previous employees who are working for other entities that come through on contracts that are engaged. Yes.
Is there any arrangement or policy around the cooling off period?
Yes, there is. We do not look at employees until they have been out of service for 5 years.
That's the policy?
Yes.
But is it being followed?
Because sometimes the challenge is not whether police is there or not, compliance with that police.
On an individual basis, yes. But when contracts are entered into, for example, for construction of dams, and specialists have joined the entities, we would probably make discoveries after the contract has been signed. And said, but it's not an individual's contract. It is a contract coming from a company or an entity that has come through bid or tender processes that has been evaluated. Thank you.
What is the difference? Because it also depends on what is the position of that former employee. Is that person a director? Is he the owner of the company? Because without going into those details, it still does not take away the fact that you have a former employee who comes and bid for work within the department. And I think for me, or for us, DG, it is compliance. Because policies might be there, but if management does not do proper monitoring and supervision, there will be deviations from established policies. And they will mean nothing by merely being there.
Chair, from DBAC, they don't come through as owners. But we may find that they are employed. For example, geohydrologists who are employed by other companies that bid. But they don't own the companies. They are as employees, and they may be listed as their specialists who will be working on the project.
All right. You want to make a follow-up? Let's say
I think that answer is not satisfactory, like you are raising this issue, because, check. You find a similar face. I'm speaking now on behalf of the constituency that I represent. And you know water is an issue, especially for some of us who come from rural villages. You find a similar face who was the director in water affairs. Now he's coming with a company, he says he's dealing with your bowls in an institution. And then that thing, an ordinary person...
Bowls.
Bowls, yes.
Not very specialized, highly skilled, scarce kind of skills. I thought that's what you were referring to. No, I hear you talk. I'm just saying what you're saying contradicts what you said.
Yes. Like, but what I'm saying, I mean, like, though the person, this argument to say is not a director of a company, but the mere fact that the person is speaking for the company, I think it needs to be addressed. And if there are instances, I think I'll talk to him. Especially, you must go and look in my province where I come from, where these people are directors of those companies and they are working for what happens.
Where are you from? So, you see the issue is not merely to talk to the conceptual framework, because that's not what we're dealing with here. We're dealing with the implementation, the practical aspect there too. So, I think it's an issue that does need to be looked at, because I saw the AG's office nodding their heads. I saw National Treasury nodding their heads when we were talking to your former employees coming to serve as consultants, and the response you gave seemed to suggest. Absolutely nothing
like that. Chair?
Right.
It's just a correction, Chair. I think we need to be very, very careful in talking loosely about whether a person is employed as a consultant, as an employee, as the director or owner of a company. There are big legal issues as to the status of that person. And consequently, there are limitations on re-employment in terms of 5 or 3 year periods. We just need to be very careful about that.
Yeah, Chair, but it doesn't prevent a colleague from asking a question. We want information, that's what we want. We're not making any assertions or anything.
No. We are all this side of the house. Okay. for the entire chain. Let me give Comrade Mateb, are there any issues that you would want to talk to, having sat through quietly, pen in hand, jotting down and listening to all these engagements from your perspective in the portfolio committee?
Yeah, thanks, sir. I was really listening very carefully. And let me also start by saying, Chair, I'm also very much disappointed to hear the officials denying the issue of consultants. Because in the portfolio committee, they have admitted that there are those who were the employees of the department and they came back as consultants. And we're still waiting for the names of those people. We requested them to bring us that list. So it has been happening in this department. There is no capacity building. So they don't have the understudy. Someone leaves and comes back and does the very same thing that he was doing as an employee. Another issue, Chair, I must say that I was disappointed to hear the acting DG earlier on saying that even this year, there will be a recurrence of some of the issues that Auditor General have identified as irregular. You know, when the officials from the Auditor General's office came to brief our committee, they told us that they proposed some quarterly meetings with the officials of the department so that they can help them put their things in order before even doing formal audit. Now, my question is, did those meetings materialize? If yes, why these things are still recurring? If they did not happen, why? Someone must take responsibility because it means there is reluctance to comply with the issues that have been identified as irregular. Another issue, Chair, is that one of the BID committee. He said that he has suspended the functions of the BID committee. But the worrying factor is, this thing did not start with this BID committee. It has been happening all along. So this investigation, why covers only this BID committee? Why didn't you start it earlier on? It should start those years, maybe 5 to 10 years back, to uncover all these things that happened in that department. Not only during the term of office of the past BID committee. There have been all these things all these years. Another issue, the acting CFO spoke of the writing off of some debt. Now, I want to know as to what steps are taken before debts are written off. And also, do you continue to do business with those companies that have written off their debts? Because it's really contradiction. If you write someone's debt off, it means you can't pay. But if you continue to do business with that particular person, where did he get money now to pay? So it means there is something exchanging brown envelopes under the table here. Thank you, sir.
All right. Oh, maybe some goods. All right. I think acting DG, I think the issues that have been raised by Comrade Mateb, just note them. And Comrade, I'm sure the issues that you have identified as you are articulating them, you can talk to the chairperson and ensure that you sit on them. What I want to stress, DG and Comrade Minister, it's if indeed what Comrade Mateva said is correct, is so, around the issue of consultants. So that we don't have officials giving us responses that are manifestly and deliberately misleading. That is wrong and is totally unacceptable. It cannot be. So I'm saying, because we're at the end, I would want you to run with this, Comrade, at your level. in terms of insisting that the names of those officers will be provided, and to say, please, we don't need this at all, at all, at all, at all. No one will come to Parliament and provide misleading information. We know that so far we've called departments voluntarily, not like they have been summoned. Otherwise, any misleading information will be a criminal offense. But it doesn't have to be because of that, because it's Parliament, who are here representing our people. So if you don't take Parliament serious, it means you don't take the people serious for whom we are employed to, you know, to provide service. So I think we need to have a proper contextualization of our engagement here. But with that as it may, I hope DG and your team, you will be able to hold things together. As Comrade Roy said from the beginning, we had a clean audit, or a qualified audit, then things slipped to a qualified audit. Hope you can be able to get the ship back on track, but it should not be one step forward, two steps back, as Lenin says. We need to make continuous progress and ensure that we consolidate and move on. We, and the other trading entity, I remember when they came to the portfolio committee last year, I mean, the reports were just too bad. So I hope the interventions that you've put in place should be able to bear fruit. And the issue around the internal audit unit, if you could deal with it the same way you are approaching the issue of the separate CFO, I'm sure it would greatly assist the water trading entity, but also the department, because then you'll have your internal audit focusing specifically on one side. The issues around non-compliance arising from the report of the Auditor General, I think we are not bloodthirsty committee. We want people to appreciate that if you operate in a rules-based environment, you must just comply with those rules. It's as simple as all that. And those who don't, you know, discipline is either observed or enforced. If it's not observed, somebody must enforce it. And if nobody enforces it, the PFMA says, what is it that should happen from that person who doesn't enforce the observance of the rules and regulations of the country? So impunity is antithetical to our sense of what is right and what needs to happen. So we are always fully behind management that acts with vigor, decisiveness and firmness. So we want to encourage you on that path. But I would want to hand over to the Minister, Corporate Minister. You sat and listened, took notes. If there are issues that you feel you need to clear or emphasize or clarify, we have this few minutes, 2, 3, 4, 5 minutes to talk to us. Yes, Comrade.
Thank you, Comrade Chair. 5 minutes is enough to greet. Just let me start by appreciating the fact that we are here to account, Comrade Chair, having been called by yourself, as you said earlier on a voluntary basis, not having been sanctioned. I would not love to have a discussion on sanctioning and not. Otherwise, it's a necessary thing to be here to account. And I have been sitting here thinking that we could take a situation at the level where I am. It's easy to take an option that says management is here, let me threat them, let me deal with them. It's easy also, I could have been here to say management is here as a department, let me protect and deal with them. And on behalf of the committee, as I said, us and them. You could have chosen to ask sweetheart questions as the committee. You didn't.
Treasury is here, the AG could have chosen to write reports that are not really quite reflecting what the image is. I'm not saying they will ever, ever do that. What am I saying? I'm saying that any one of us could have taken, opted any of such a route of that nature. However, we understand that we're dealing with public monies. We're taking care of funds of the people, and we've got to all comply, and we've got to all be as rigorous as possible in terms of ensuring that there is compliance and there is adequate accountability, full accountability, not adequate, to the monies that we're dealing with. Having said that, I want to therefore assure this committee that from our side, we will do our level best to really address the issues that have been raised by both the AG as well as the issues raised as per the request of the former minister, that those things should be investigated, and they've been investigated. So we'll follow them, definitely follow them up. It is an obligation, it's not a request. And therefore, Chair, the issue, let me start with the political, very big political question raised by Honourable Member Pretoria. The number of trips that are in this report by the minister, former minister and the deputy minister has been mentioned as an issue perhaps that may have stopped or to some extent disturbed the oversight role that was mentioned. I do want to undertake that we will definitely play that oversight role, as we have always done in the past, without necessarily not doing the other task that we have to do. We are obliged to travel world across to do these other tasks, because I'm sure that those ministers were actually not visiting just for the sake of visiting. So we will really do all of those tasks, because once again, if we can arrive at a portfolio committee, not this committee, and be asked, why is it that you cost us COP17 not to be a success? Why is it that South Africans asked, why is it that you cost us COP17 not to be a success? We can't say public accounts, SCOPA said, we should travel less. So we've got to do all those things in the same vein, doing overall oversight rule, which we'll do. This management that's sitting here knows that we have agreed that even if it means that we've got to meet at night, but we've got to do all those roles. We've got to perform them. So I really don't want to sit and assure Comrade Chair through you that we will not do the other tasks, but we'll do them and play the oversight role very viciously and very rigorously. There are issues that have been raised about the dismissal of members in the department. There are issues that are related to whether they, based on those dismissals or even as we respond to these issues, whether there would be immediate improvement. I don't think we want to sit here and lie to you. That's not part of our job. We've got to say that, as we said, that we're doing our best. And I think if we were to calculate, to be given an opportunity, Chair, to calculate the percentage of at least things that we've been able to address so far, we will be able to say, and I just a quick calculation, I think we are probably somewhere at about 80% or so, in terms of putting systems in place, if you listen to the issues. There are those things that we still have to really come back to and deal with very vigorously. However, I think what was said earlier on, if I may just amplify this point, is that there are issues that keeps coming and rearing their ugly heads. And some are new, some may be the same people who may still be inside, some may be, we're dealing with those. We haven't actually shared with you some of the things that we're discovering here today. through other means. And it's for that reason that we said that we're going to get the SIU in for them to investigate and actually deal with some of the things that we haven't spoken about here or emphasized, including retrieving some of the monies that have actually been lost. I heard earlier on, Honorable Member Koshi was saying, Honorable Member saying that it's the money has been lost. I don't think we should conclude that that money has been lost completely, because there will still be some areas where we think that there's need to retrieve some of the funds that have gone in under. And that's the reason why we actually are approaching this matter this way. The issues of leadership internal in management, as it has been alluded to earlier on, and in several areas, including at the water trading entity, have been noted. And as we have indicated earlier on, that we're really working hard day and night to ensure that that capacity is acquired, especially into turning the water trading entity around. And I think much more important, if I may just highlight this point before I go on, I sensed and I think that what the acting DG was saying earlier on about the fact that we still see some of the things being happening that have been noticed. It's not that we're saying that we are just going to sit back and not get anything done about the reports that are in front of us or even to improve. But if you look at the water trading entity itself, we require a whole lot of time to achieve and a whole lot of energy and other measures that are beyond what we've discussed here today to actually turn that entity around or that part of the entity around, including thinking very hard about whether we are structured correctly in having that entity, including that. Whether some of the functions that are performed in the water trading entity shouldn't be cutting across, or are they supposed to be a TCTA and so on. We're asking ourselves those deep questions. So there's a long-term process of evaluation and assessment that we're doing in relation to that, including staffing and so on of that entity. So what am I saying? I'm saying that I recognize and acknowledge that we almost have a near crisis in that entity, and I think that we're working very hard on it day and night. We want to assure you that with this management here, I think they've done a lot. I'm very confident that they are going the right direction with our direction. However, I might need to emphasize that the CFO that we are acquiring, or the services of the CFO that we acquire, is not the CFO of a public entity that's Schedule 3 or something. So it will not necessarily be quite an equivalent, because that's not quite an entity, that's not a department. Chair, I want to underscore this matter, because when we looked at why this water trading entity was left with these challenges for quite a long time, this is one of the reasons that came up. Because the DG former, then we're told, said that there is a challenge in that you're likely to have somebody who's at equal status with the accounting officer or something like that. So there are issues that about accounting lines, accounting, whatever, that we've got to spell out. We don't believe that that is actually the case, but we've got to clarify all those things so that there's nobody who's trampling on anybody's fingers and toes as we move on with this issue. So, yes, we'll have those the CFO coming and talking to us at all times in terms of accounting as we come here as a team. So gradual turnaround, very fast, yes, we are going there, and that's the direction we are going. And we want to appreciate the fact that even the previous minister has really been trying. And I think I want to say here, Chair, before you and the entire committee, that I have no doubt that internally in the department, there are people with capacity. What has been the problem is leadership enforcement, not leadership capacity, leadership enforcement at the top to actually drive the entire team. And that's where we think that we have to go. With a new DG, whoever will be the new DG who's coming, we will drive this process together with the other, all other members who are coming. The turnaround strategy, the business process, re-engineering that we referred to gradually earlier on, in passing earlier on, is intended to actually get us on, get up so that we speak to the challenges that are facing us as government and even fulfilling a service delivery on behalf of all of us and as government. And we undertake just to do that. With regards to issues of corruption, I want to say that we will stop at nothing to ensure that we really deal with these issues. The AMD issue, I don't think it has been touched on. Yes, it does. It does not appear here. But there's just one part that I think we need to just amplify on or add, Chair, through you, is that we have agreed, even at the portfolio committee level, not portfolio committee, in the other discussions at portfolio committee level, that we are going to really, it's a cabinet decision, that the polluter pays principle has got to be implemented. This problem of AMD, even if we're spending money right now, it shouldn't be that we end up spending money continuously as government on a problem that we know is going to perpetually go on. So we need to find mechanism to get those who are dealing and actually causing this problem to actually find, you know, in one way or another, get them to contribute in a forward-looking manner to us dealing, being able to deal with this problem. So it's a kind of an environmental levy, it's a kind of a tax, whatever form it's going to take, whatever consultation has started in that regard that we're dealing with. We'll come back to you on issues of consultants. We have ourselves in the department as ministry already begun asking this question about consultants, and we're expecting that list will go through this, we'll sift it and definitely look at who is in this thing. But I think there's something that I heard that was coming, and this is what we're going to have to analyze. Whether the consultants who have come back to the department, do they come back as people who have, as you were trying to say earlier on, Chair, do they come back as professionals who now occupy certain professional posts or come back with companies that now does work like cleaning the grass elsewhere and so on, in their own capacity as South Africans dealing with other companies? I think we need to analyze all those things, but definitely we'll look at this, we'll analyze as we come back to the committee, we'll come back. We're coming back with the very clear understanding of what is this thing. And definitely I don't think it's the intention of any one of us to undermine and even tell that which is not the truth. But I think what the gentleman was saying and what you also said and what Mr. I can't remember who is honorable member said earlier on, we need to analyze that whole spectrum of this whole issue of the consultant. And definitely, I think even with the nodding of the treasury heads, I think they will help us in this regard in AG. Definitely, if we find that these are people who are doing what? Javelin? No, we can't accept javelin. It has to be dealt with. So thank you very much. Thank you. And I think that we will be able to just quantify and come back to you, Chair, even without calling us, and keep on sending a report about how far we are in relation to some of the issues that you raised here today.
Yeah.
Finally, the DG's matter, I think, has been discussed. The term of office has come to an end on the 28th of February. There were some discussions, pending matter, at conciliation level with the dispute that was spoken about. We are going to have to go ahead to advertise or to do whatever processes of acquiring and ensuring that there is a DG, fully-fledged DG in the department, having had discussions at GPSA level and at presidency level. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Comrade Minister. We fully appreciate the, I think, the point that Honourable Pretorius was driving right at the beginning, the sense that the political leadership is also there pushing and driving the processes. As always, the tone is set from the top, and then it cascades throughout the entity. We want to thank you very much, Comrade Minister, as well as the DG and your team, National Treasury officials, Auditor General's office. Comrades, thanks very much. We
Sina, we meet tomorrow for our plenary, 10 o'clock.